The Braille Monitor, Volume 59, Number 9, October 2016, Gary Wunder, Editor. Distributed by email, in inkprint, in Braille, and on USB flash drive by the National Federation of the Blind. Mark Riccobono, President. Telephone 410-659-9314. Email address nfb@nfb.org. Website address http://www.nfb.org. NFBnet.org, http://www.nfbnet.org. NFB Newsline Information, 866-504-7300. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/National Federation of the Blind. Follow us on Twitter, @NFB_voice. Watch and share our videos, youtube.com/NationsBlind. Letters to the President, address changes, subscription requests, and orders for NFB literature should be sent to the National Office. Articles for the Monitor and letters to the Editor may also be sent to the National Office or may be emailed to gwunder, G-W-U-N-D-E-R, @NFB.org. Monitor subscriptions cost the Federation about $40 per year. Members are invited and non-members are requested to cover the subscription cost. Donations should be made payable to National Federation of the Blind and sent to National Federation of the Blind, 200 East Wells Street at Jernigan Place, Baltimore, Maryland, 21230-4998. The National Federation of the Blind knows that blindness is not the characteristic that defines you or your future. Every day we raise the expectations of blind people because low expectations create obstacles between blind people and our dreams. You can live the life you want. Blindness is not what holds you back. The National Federation of the Blind is not an organization speaking for the blind. It is the blind speaking for ourselves. Each issue is recorded on a thumb drive, also called a memory stick or USB flash drive. You can read this audio edition using a computer or a National Library Service digital player. The NLS machine has two slots, the familiar book cartridge slot just above the retractable carrying handle and a second slot located on the right side near the headphone jack. This smaller slot is used to play thumb drives. Remove the protective rubber pad covering this slot and insert the thumb drive. It will insert only in one position. If you encounter resistance, flip the drive over and try again. Note, if the cartridge slot is not empty when you first insert the thumb drive, the digital player will ignore the thumb drive. Once the thumb drive is inserted, the player buttons will function as usual for reading digital materials. If you remove the thumb drive to use the player for cartridges, when you insert it again, reading should resume at the point you stopped. You can transfer the recording of each issue from the thumb drive to your computer or preserve it on the thumb drive. However, because thumb drives can be used hundreds of times, we would appreciate their return in order to stretch our funding. Please use the return envelope enclosed with the drive when you return the device. Volume 59, Number 9, October 2016, Contents. Illustration. Summer Interns Come to Contribute and Learn. That NFB Resolution by Jonathan Mosen. Putting News First, Breaking Down Stereotypes as a Blind Journalist by Gary O'Donohue. A Community of Practice, The Federation in Science, Technology, Engineering, Art, and Math by Natalie Shaheen, Joseph Heimlich, Ariana Benelli, Francis Hammond, Cricket Bittleman, and Salvador Villa. Participating in the American Dream Means Paying Taxes, The Innovation of Accessible Financial Tools at H&R Block by Brett Reimer. The Roots of the Federation in the World, The Isabel Grant Story in Her Own Words by Deborah Kent Stein. Eliminating Artificial Barriers, Civil Rights and Disability at the United States Department of Justice by Eve Hill. Educational Assessments, Math Innovations and Real Accessibility, Progress at Pearson, by John Twing. Recipes, Monitor Miniatures. Summer Interns Come to Contribute and Learn. There is a photo on the page, the caption, John Paré, Michael Osbun, Mark Riccobono, Julie McGinnity with her dog guide Bill in front of her, Jared Nyland, and Anil Lewis posed together in front of the Jernigan Institute. From the beginning of June through the early part of August, the Jernigan Institute hosted three interns who had demonstrated a commitment to the organization, possessed leadership potential, and demonstrated energy and enthusiasm in earlier Federation work. The purpose of the internship was twofold: to build on this leadership and to tackle some much-needed work that would challenge their creativity and their ability to work as a team. The 2016 interns were Michael Alsman of Nevada, Julie McGinnity of Missouri, and Jared Nyland of Iowa. Jared and Michael worked together on STEM-EQ, and both say that working as mentors in the program was a mountaintop experience. Jared said that the experience he found most valuable was learning his own strengths and weaknesses and how important communication is in working as a team. Michael loved being a mentor and found that contact with his own mentors and fellow interns was the most valuable part of his experience. Julie thought that being an intern gave her a wonderful view of the Federation nationally and enjoyed her work planning for and executing a plan for affiliate building. All of the interns went to Capitol Hill to support the Federation's legislative priorities. Not only do they learn more about the process, but getting to know the senators, representatives, and the staff members who play important roles for our public servants was enormously helpful. Perhaps Julie McGinnity best summed up their feelings as they move on to new challenges. "The internship didn't lead me to a destination. It led me to believe in the worthiness of our further journey." That NFB Resolution by Jonathan Mosen. There is a photo on the page, the caption, "Jonathan Mosen." From the editor, Jonathan Mosen is well known to many blind people who follow technology. He was a prominent spokesman for HumanWare when they introduced the Braille Note and now hosts the popular FSCast, sponsored by the VFO Group, formerly Freedom Scientific. This article first appeared on July 7, 2016, in a blog entry on Mosen Consulting's website. At the 2016 convention, this organization passed Resolution 2016-04. It was controversial, not because anyone disputed the truth of the assertions, but because it criticized Apple for quality control. Apple is a company which is credited by anyone with brains with breaking a barrier many of us feared would stifle technological progress for the blind. They figured out a way to make a touchscreen usable by blind people when it seemed that the very nature of the technology would preclude any exploration to find the number or the button desired. No matter how much the NFB applauds Apple for its innovations through the purchase of its products, favorable articles and user reviews, and even granting them the most prestigious award we have for the developers of technology, any word of criticism is regarded by some as blasphemy. Let the Federation be a watchdog seeking to ensure fair treatment by a blindness agency, an accrediting body, or a government policy or procedure, and the organization is either applauded for taking a stand or criticized for not taking a more forceful one. But let us speak about Apple, and suddenly we are unappreciative, overly critical, and unduly demanding. Whether we like it or not, the controversy over the resolution passed concerning Apple raises serious questions about what we, who are blind, think about blind people. Are we full-fledged consumers with the right to say when something we have purchased doesn't work as it should? Do we have real rights when it comes to expressing our views, or must we confine ourselves to saying only what those who rely on charity and goodwill have the right to say? No matter how courteously or constructively our concerns are put forward, if they involve Apple, they cause a firestorm which inevitably finds people questioning our motives, our reasonableness, and our record of working constructively, not only for access, but for the ability to efficiently use devices so important to our daily existence. It is refreshing to see that some who are not associated with us share our opinion that calling for quality access is not a violation of civilized behavior and that, in fact, we must exercise our rights as consumers whose money is as hard to come by and every bit as valuable as the money offered to Apple by people who can see. To help with a bit of translation, when Jonathan says, "I do so fully recognizing that I'm on a hiding to nothing," he meant that he is engaging in a bet which he is likely to lose and that the payoff is likely not worth the risk. Here is what he says. "In writing this post, I do so fully recognizing that I'm on a hiding to nothing, and I should probably leave well enough alone. There is an ugly mob mentality that can easily get going when social media turns on an individual or organization, and it's a phenomenon that has been the fascinating subject of entire books." But after initially deciding to sit out the latest NFB resolution controversy, I decided I was being morally complicit in the mob mentality by not having the courage to share my own story and views. I was also encouraged to write this because of an amicable and reasonable Twitter exchange I had with someone whose views are not identical to mine. It made me realize that there still may be reasonable people who might appreciate a different perspective on this issue. So, for better or worse, here goes. The resolution. In case you've been fortunate enough to be under a rock and off the grid, the National Federation of the Blind has just concluded its 2016 convention. NFB is a consumer organization that also provides services, now extending to the development of assistive technology that runs on a range of platforms, including iOS. Resolutions can be proposed by any member. They are first discussed at the Resolutions Committee. The Resolutions Committee then votes on whether they should be discussed by the Convention, which is the supreme governing and policy-making body of the organization. So if you pay your subscription, (join the Federation, you too could propose a resolution next year. The following resolution was proposed and ultimately adopted by NFB. Resolution 2016-04 regarding Apple's inadequate testing of software releases. Whereas Apple Incorporated has made VoiceOver, a free and powerful screen access program, an integral part of many of its products, including the Apple Macintosh, iPhone, iPod Touch, Apple TV, and iPad. And whereas, when a significant software update for one of these products is released, there are often accessibility bugs that impact the usability of the product by blind users, causing them to lose their productivity or their ability to perform certain job duties when the use of Apple devices is required. And whereas, recent updates have included a large number of serious, moderate, and minor bugs that have made it difficult or impossible for blind people to perform various tasks, such as answering calls, browsing the internet, entering text into forms, or adding individuals to the contact's favorites list. And whereas, for example, after iOS 9 was released, some iPhones running VoiceOver occasionally became unresponsive when getting a phone call, and there was no way to choose any option on screen. And whereas, although this issue was fixed in a new release of iOS, it would not have occurred if Apple had conducted more thorough testing with VoiceOver. And whereas another example of inadequate testing by Apple involves VoiceOver failing to render the contents of the screen when a user attempts to add a contact to the favorites list in the phone app and has multiple contact groups from which to select. And whereas, because Apple products and its accessibility tools are built by the same company, there is no need to share confidential information with partners that may affect the normal development of the software. And whereas, we recognize the efforts made by Apple to inform developers about the accessibility features built into Apple products and encourages the company to keep working in that direction. However, several accessibility issues still appear with new software releases even when they have been reported during beta testing. And whereas, it is vital that Apple give priority to addressing bugs that have an impact on accessibility before releasing software updates. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the National Federation of the Blind in convention assembled this 4th day of July, 2016, in the city of Orlando, Florida, that this organization call upon Apple to make non-visual access a major priority in its new and updated software by improving its testing of new releases to ensure that non-visual access is not limited or compromised. And be it further resolved that this organization call upon Apple to work actively to incorporate feedback from testers who use VoiceOver during the beta testing phase of software development to ensure that accessibility for blind individuals is fully and properly addressed. Quality control. Quality control problems are rampant within Apple, not just where accessibility is concerned, but with software in general. If you take even the most cursory of glances at the technology news, you'll have seen a number of examples. Most recently, some units of Apple's latest pride and joy, the 9.7-inch iPad Pro, were bricked by what was supposed to be a minor software update. Some Sprint users couldn't connect to LTE after iOS 9.3. You may remember that a minor update to iOS 8 broke LTE functionality, causing massive problems for those who were unfortunate enough to upgrade before the update was pulled. The issues with VoiceOver and iOS 9 were just the latest in a series of significant problems over the last few years. I could go back further, but let's just look at iOS 8 on release day. There were serious issues affecting the two-finger double tap when an incoming call was received. Answering a call would not always pause audio that was playing, and the phone could get itself into a state where it was difficult to stop audio without hanging up a call. Remember the dial pad bug in iOS 8? If you tried to do something as simple as call a number using the phone keypad, it would often get stuck emitting a DTMF tone. Each key you pressed would cause one tone to pile on another. On iOS 8 release day, Bluetooth keyboard support with VoiceOver on was so unreliable that it was useless for practical purposes. If you had a Braille display and no Bluetooth keyboard, QuickNav was stuck on and there was no way you could disable it unless you were able to borrow someone else's keyboard and pair it, or buy a Bluetooth keyboard expressly to get around Apple's bug. When VoiceOver was enabled, Siri would often be cut off in its responses. And the really big one. VoiceOver was completely broken if you had a Braille display and had chosen a particular configuration for status cells. There was no way to recover from this one without sighted assistance. Let's move on to iOS 9. This was the release that the tech press said would be lighter on features because there was a need to make the OS more stable. Do you remember how flaky Bluetooth keyboard support was for some of us, only when VoiceOver was running? There were times when entering text into an edit field did absolutely nothing. If you were really lucky, turning VoiceOver off and back on again got things working for a while. If you were a little less lucky, but still a bit lucky, rebooting the device would get things working. Still others couldn't get Bluetooth keyboards working at all, no matter what they did. I remember long, convoluted Twitter discussions as many of us tried to find the variable that would make Bluetooth keyboards work. Remember the famous iOS 9 focus bug? This was a particular problem in apps where you'd want to return to your previous place, such as Twitter and podcast apps. It made using apps like Twitterific, Tweetings, or Downcast a miserable experience because you couldn't pick up from where you left off. There were numerous other ones, but let me be clear that every piece of software ever written has bugs, so I want to focus on the really big one. As the NFB resolution mentioned, there was the call answering issue, a showstopper if there ever was one. It saddens me that many of those who were not affected by it trivialized the impact that it had on those of us who were. To recap, when you received an incoming phone or FaceTime call, VoiceOver became unresponsive. It wasn't possible to answer a call or navigate the screen. I can tell you that as a business owner and a dad, this was a very high-impact bug, and it was totally unacceptable that the software was released in this state. Don't agree? Well, let's take blindness out of the mix for a bit. What do you think would have happened if even 20% of the entire iPhone user base found after installing iOS 9 that they couldn't take phone calls anymore? It would be Apple Maps all over again. Apple would have been a laughingstock for making a phone that doesn't even let you answer the phone. The blind business owner who relies on their iPhone to get their sales leads, the blind attorney who needs to hear from their office, the blind parent who needs to be able to pick up a call from their kid, they've all paid exactly the same money for their iPhone as anyone else. And if it's not unacceptable for sighted people to be unable to answer their phone, not just occasionally, but always, then allowing software to go out that makes it impossible for numerous blind people to answer the phone is an act of discrimination. It's not deliberate, it's not willful, but discrimination need not be deliberate or willful for discrimination to have taken place. We have enough barriers and ignorance to overcome without these sorts of preventable barriers getting in our way. These devices aren't toys, they're now an essential tool in our productivity armory for many of us. I have seen it suggested that this serious call answering bug was introduced late in the beta cycle, too late for Apple to do anything about. This is unequivocally false, and I'm going to give you dates to back that statement up. First, a bit of background. I believe in trying to make constructive, positive contributions where that's an option. All the way back in iOS 7, many of us had become troubled by the dwindling quality control of Apple's accessibility offerings. To try to make a positive difference, I set up a private email list of registered blind Apple developers. The idea was, and is, that we compare notes and try to find steps to reproduce a bug so we can lodge the most accurate bugs we can with Apple. Incidentally, the very accessibility of lodging bugs has varied a lot over the years, from the excellent to the near impossible. This email list means that I can tell you exactly when I became aware of the serious call answering bug. Bonnie and I were married on 27 June last year. I therefore refrained from installing the iOS 9 beta on my main device until we were back from our honeymoon. On 4 July, I first reported issues with answering calls. By that stage, we were only at iOS 9 Beta 3. I suspect that if the bug was present early on in the cycle like that, it was present from the beginning. Certainly it was present in early July, a full 2.5 months before iOS 9 was officially released. When I lodged the bug, I gave it the highest priority I could, stressing emphatically what a showstopper this one was. I was also able to make it clear, because of the private email list I run, that it was affecting some people, but not others. Some people with the same model phone as I had were affected, while other users of the very same model were not. I have huge empathy for the Apple quality assurance folks, because a bug like this, that affects some people but not others, is the absolute worst to track down. Nevertheless, the software was released in the full knowledge that there were going to be some blind people for whom a core function of the device they paid for was useless, and I would be surprised if I had been the first person to log the issue in early July. As the resolution also pointed out, Apple is in a unique position, and it's something they market as a strength. They have full control over all the hardware and software. They're not trying to provide access over the top of an operating system. It's part of the operating system. iOS 9 was also the first iOS release to go into public beta. As I blogged when that move was announced, having more data to draw from isn't going to help if quality assurance isn't resourced appropriately. And really, this is all the resolution is saying. I can't speak for its drafters, but I can say that I'm not for one second suggesting that Apple is lessening its commitment to accessibility. Far from it. If you've got your hands on iOS 10 already, you'll know that it's packed with some cool new accessibility features, some of which I've been wanting for years. I don't question for a single second that everyone at Apple has a deeply entrenched, profound commitment to accessibility, and through it, to making the world a better place. They sure have changed my life for the better, and chances are, if you're reading this, they've changed yours too. But surely dialogue in our community hasn't descended to the notion that unless you're totally for Apple, you're against them. Clearly, Apple continues to have quality control issues across the board. You'd have to be pretty blinkered not to acknowledge that. In my view, it's not that anyone there isn't truly dedicated or competent, but there clearly seems to be a resource shortfall in quality assurance. Many users of Apple's tech, from a range of perspectives, have said similarly, and I for one am glad that the NFB has reminded Apple and the wider public of how vulnerable we blind people are when quality assurance is under-resourced. We're a small population, and bugs that have a tiny impact on the user base overall can have a debilitating impact on us. Picking apples. It's been said by some that NFB seems to be picking on Apple, perhaps because Apple doesn't engage with our community in the same way other companies do. I don't always succeed at this, but I find that not much good comes from attributing motive, and that it's best to take an argument on its merits if possible. As someone very badly hit by the phone answering bug, I felt heard, understood, relieved that finally someone was speaking up for me. It's also natural that with Apple having done so well, more blind people are using Apple mobile devices than any other type. With that success, inevitably comes greater scrutiny. However, I'd like to have been spoken up for in other ways as well. I'm an Android user now, and would use Android more if it weren't for the abysmal state of support for my primary medium, Braille. NFB has championed Braille over the years, and a resolution letting Google know in no uncertain terms that they must do better would be both welcome and overdue. Technology plays such a big part in all of our lives now that I suspect there are a number of cases where we'd like to see tech companies do much better. Perhaps Americans who feel this way will put forward their own resolutions next year. I don't believe that the absence of these resolutions in any way invalidates the strength of the resolution that was adopted, but when we as blind people call for truly equitable access, I do think that such calls should also be equitably distributed. NFB said something that clearly needed to be said. The impact of unresolved accessibility bugs has been dire for 3 consecutive major releases now, and is symptomatic of a wider software QA, bracket, quality assurance, close bracket, issue. In constructively pointing out the need for meaningful dialogue and timely resolution, that doesn't preclude us from celebrating the revolution Apple has brought about, for which they deserve warm congratulations. And despite the strong market share of mobile devices Apple enjoys in our community, it is critical that we also focus on other players who are not doing so well, so that, like everyone else, we as blind people truly can choose the technology we use based on preference and need. Putting News First, Breaking Down Stereotypes as a Blind Journalist by Gary O'Donohue. There is a photo on the page, the caption, Gary O'Donohue. From the editor, Gary O'Donohue is the Washington correspondent for the British Broadcasting Company, BBC. Being a successful blind journalist in the position he holds requires extensive travel, the ability to turn an event into a story, and the flexibility to see that blindness does not get in the way of being where the action is and turning out an article that catches the attention of readers and is worthy of the most prestigious broadcasting service in the world. Here is what Gary O'Donohue said to the 2016 convention.
Well, it's great to be here, and I'm very grateful for the invitation from the President to come and speak to you and to tell you a little bit about what I do in my work as a journalist. As the President was saying, this isn't my first NFB convention. I was lucky enough to be here last year to witness that famous record-breaking umbrella mosaic, an amazing moment, of course. Though I have to tell you that I've been to one or two Donald Trump rallies this year, and they are no more frightening than 3,000 blind people waving umbrellas around, let me tell you. Now, what I want to do today, at the invitation of your President, is give a bit of an insight into my work as a BBC correspondent and how I go about doing that as a visually impaired person. First of all, perhaps the potted life story. I was born with poor sight, which led to me having one eye removed when I was a baby. I retained some useful vision in the other eye until I was 8 years old, but after a retina that kept detaching itself, admittedly once after going headfirst over the handlebars of a bicycle, there was nothing more to be done, and I've been totally blind ever since then. As was the norm in those days, I was immediately packed off to a couple of boarding schools for blind people. And as luck would have it, it got me a much better education than I could have hoped for if I'd been sighted. From boarding school, I headed off to Oxford University to do a degree in philosophy and modern languages. And shortly after that, I joined the BBC as a reporter, and I've been there ever since. So I'm about as institutionalized a blind person as you can get. Now, when I started in this field, there were only very basic forms of computers. Mobile phones were only just getting going. And access to research materials and daily newspapers as a blind person meant getting on to other colleagues and getting them to take time out of their schedules to assist. One could, of course, take all the bits of paper home for the girlfriend to read, but I'm pretty sure one left, because asking her to read a wedge of newspaper cuttings in bed wasn't the most alluring offer she could have from a guy, right? I worked at first producing reports from our parliament, for the BBC's network of local radio stations. From there, I got a job on a national daily news programme called the Today programme, which is a bit like NPR's morning edition here, and which is a significant force in setting the political agenda in Britain each day. During those 5 years, I did a good range of stories, really. A lot of travel to Africa several times, here to the US a few times, the Far East during the handover of Hong Kong back to the Chinese, and I spent a couple of nights on the Macedonian border while NATO bombed Serbia and thousands of Kosovan refugees flooded out of the country, many of them driven out by their Serb neighbours. I did lots of lighter things as well. I had to cuddle a koala in Australia. Now, apparently they pee a lot, but fortunately this one did not pee. I had to drink lots of strong lager for a piece on alcohol content, all in the line of duty, of course. And I had to talk to people about the shape of tea bags on Oxford Street, would you believe? I must say I did draw the line, though, when I was asked to do a bungee jump off a bridge over the River Thames. I thought that was just a little step too far for me. Now, after a stint at the BBC World Service, I became one of the BBC's political correspondents, ending up as the chief political correspondent for our major main news network. And that, my friends, is what brought me here to the United States. Since I arrived here, I've spent a lot of time chasing presidential candidates across the country as they eat their corn dogs at country fairs, plate loads of beef at cookouts, and do their, 15 minutes flipping burgers or serving behind diners, the length and breadth of this country. I've been chilled to the bone in New Hampshire. I've been so close to Canada and Vermont I could almost touch it. Texas was pleasant in the spring, but I have to tell you that I'm relieved not to be there today because apparently it's going to be 102, which kind of makes Orlando seem fine, doesn't it? And you only need to listen to Americans talking to realize how big this place is. Even a couple of hours west of DC, it almost sounds like you're in a foreign country. Though Donald Trump did actually divert to a foreign country 10 days ago when he made a speech at his golf course in Scotland. I have to say, sitting at the ninth tee at Turnberry, surrounded by Secret Service agents, was one of the most bizarre places I've ever attended a press conference. Not only does the presidential election campaign reach every part of the US, it also seems to go on forever, doesn't it? I was with Hillary Clinton in Iowa when she launched her campaign in the spring of last year. Shout out for Iowa there. And today we're still 4 months away from the general election and 6 months away from Inauguration Day. Compare that to the process going on in Britain at the moment. 10 days ago, the Prime Minister, David Cameron, announced he'd be standing down after his side lost the EU referendum vote. Today, as I'm speaking to you, Conservative MPs, members of Parliament, are voting on who their next leader should be. Of course, it won't be decided today. There'll be more votes among MPs, and then the Conservative membership in the country will get their say. But Brits will have a new Conservative leader and a new Prime Minister by the beginning of September. So I'm afraid our political chaos is at least a little bit shorter than your political chaos. But whether standing outside a diner in Iowa waiting for Hillary Clinton to show up, or in the corridors of Westminster waiting for the results of a vote among Conservative MPs to be announced, one thing is absolutely crucial to my job: information. As you all know, information and access to it is one of the central challenges to a blind person's life, both personal and professional. Technology has done wonders in this field for us. Whether it's the accessible iPhone that allows me to read the New York Times each day and to keep up with the endless twittering and bloggings in the politosphere, or the Braille display which allows me to read out my radio and television scripts when I'm delivering a broadcast. I'm reading from a Braille display right now. And can I just say in this forum how much I think and how much I rate the NFB's Newsline service. Scott White and his team who run it, I can't thank you enough. It makes my job infinitely easier. And for all of us who rely on the ability to read a daily newspaper quickly and efficiently, I simply don't know what I'd do without it. So thank you very much. A word about Braille here. Braille, I know, isn't for everyone. It's especially hard for those to learn when they lose their sight later in life. And I'm all for encouraging people with useful vision to maximise their use of it. Sight is, after all, the most powerful sense, whether we like it or not. But Braille, to me, is an absolute necessity. I simply couldn't do my job without it. And I'm convinced that Braille displays and note takers have given it a new lease of life that we should spread to as many of our blind youngsters as possible. Another thing I believe we have to impart to the young people with visual impairments is some sense of what you might call resilience. This is a very difficult subject, because by that I mean the kind of sophisticated toughness it takes to live an independent life as a blind person. It's about the strategies to overcome the barriers when they present themselves and live an independent life, but take on the world doing those challenging, high-profile jobs that people who can see have traditionally thought might not be for us. Now, what I don't mean is being thick-skinned. We don't want our young people to become hardened or unable to empathise with others. But it's crucial we give them the confidence to believe in themselves and to pick themselves up after the world has knocked them down. And as importantly, the skills that will allow them to function in a world that, let's face it, is not designed for blind people. They'll also have to learn that even when they've built up years of experience, they'll come across people who treat them like novices when they move into a new job. I got quite a lesson in resilience a few years ago. I had some difficulties in my work and had to make a decision about whether to confront a situation which had developed. I'm afraid for legal reasons I can't go into great detail, but it was an incredibly hard decision to make, and it took an awful lot out of me and those around me and my family in particular. But I'm glad I did, and some good did come from it. But more importantly, I could live with myself going forward. We can't fight every battle there is, but when the real ones come along, it's our duty to stand up, not just for ourselves, but for those who come after us. But back to the practicalities of the job. There's a pattern I've noticed over the past 20 years or so. Technological leaps forward have unquestionably helped us as blind people to do a much wider range of things. But each time we seem to catch up, a new innovation threatens to reverse the advance. So the old DOS computers We got they had screen readers developed for them that worked just fine. Then Windows came along, of course, and we were back to the drawing board. We get that sorted, and a bit later, the touch screen hoves into vision over the horizon, and it looks like there will be a problem yet again. My point here is that we must continue to focus on what's next and ensure that a digital divide doesn't open up for blind people, because we know what that will mean for the already poor chances of getting a job and leading an independent life. In the realm of journalism, there are some big challenges ahead for young blind people wanting to get into that field. Most notably, in my view, is the ever-growing importance of multimedia journalism that requires the reporter not just to get the story, but also to gather her own pictures and video. Couple that with the speed at which one has to work in the news gathering field now, it's going to require someone with high levels of technical skills and personal resilience to make it in this trade when they have a disability. One word of encouragement, though. I don't want to sound like I'm discouraging people, but journalism at heart remains the business of telling stories. So for blind people who inevitably rely on verbal communications and verbal skills, it's still a very, very good fit. Conducting an interview still only requires a conversation to take place and the means to record it or film it. Visually impaired people are all well accustomed to having to go to the extra mile to understand others, and that again is a hugely useful skill in the realm of journalism. Now, I've rambled on for long enough, so let me just say this to you. I feel hugely, hugely privileged with how life has panned out for me. Most of the time, I see my blindness as an inconvenience, and that's the extent of it. I'm not so naive as to believe that blind people don't face huge barriers to overcome, some natural, some put in our way. But the truth is that there's no other option other than to get out there and do it. Some days it will be hard. Walking into lampposts, if I might borrow one of your American idioms, some days that just really sucks, doesn't it? Some days we have to deal with a world that doesn't really get it, and worse, stands in the way of one making the most of oneself. But we have to, I think, in the words of Winston Churchill, keep buggering on. And that's all there is to it. Thank you very much.
A community of practice, the Federation in Science, Technology, Engineering, Art, and Math, by Natalie Shaheen, Joseph Heimlich, Arianna Benelli, Francis Hammond, Cricket Bittleman, and Salvador Villa. From the editor, what we say about blindness is significantly different from what others say about it, but what we do to give credence to our words is what changes people's lives, what makes them better, and what sets them free. Nowhere is this better demonstrated than in our programs for young people. What follows is a panel discussion introduced and guided by Natalie Shaheen. As you read these remarks, consider how life might have been different for you had there been a STEM2U program when you were young enough to have benefited from it. This was a treat to behold, and hopefully we can bring it to life in these pages. Enjoy.
As a kid, I really liked math, and I was pretty good at it, too. In high school, I took extra math just for fun, and I loved it. Science class, on the other hand, wasn't as interesting to me in my freshman and sophomore years. I found the subject matter rather straightforward and the pace of the classes too slow. I was bored because I wasn't challenged. In my junior year, I decided to take advanced chemistry, hoping for more of a challenge. Well, ask and you shall receive. Chemistry presented a significant intellectual challenge, one that, at the time, I felt was beyond me. I put 110% into chemistry class, but I could never quite grasp the concepts. I ended up getting a C in that class, one of two C's I've received in my entire educational career. I was devastated. It sounds sort of goofy, but for 16-year-old perfectionist Natalie Shaheen, the bad chemistry grade was traumatic. I left that class angry, embarrassed, and fed up with science. I concluded that I just wasn't smart enough for hard sciences. It wasn't until I came to work for the National Federation of the Blind and was assigned to make a wide variety of STEM subjects accessible to blind students that I realized what had happened in chemistry class all those years ago. In chemistry, I didn't do the experiments. In order for me to see what I was doing, I would have had to get dangerously close to toxic substances and fire. The teachers, of course, didn't want me to get hurt, and they didn't know how I was going to do chemistry if I couldn't see what I was doing. And I certainly didn't have any answers for them. I couldn't even phone a blind friend to ask for advice. I didn't have any blind friends. I didn't have a community of practice of blind people who could help me figure out how to do science non-visually. So I suffered through chemistry class as the note taker for my group, trying to understand the content without having full access to the activities. The C I received in chemistry did not, as I once thought, reflect my lack of capacity for doing chemistry. Rather, it reflected my lack of access to the subject matter. Thanks to the work of the National Federation of the Blind, today, blind high school students have a community of practice of blind people who can share wisdom and advice about how to do all kinds of STEM subjects non-visually. Well, what exactly is a community of practice? So as not to bore you with the long academic definition, I'll give you the Twitter-style definition, 140 characters or fewer. Is it possible? A community of practice is a group of people who organize themselves, share information, and apprentice novices to become experts. Our community of practice, the National Federation of the Blind, organized itself in 1940. To this day, we share information and advice with each other about how to be successful in the world, and we apprentice novice blind people to become expert blind people. Though we do not commonly use the term apprenticeship, we practice apprenticeship every day in the Federation. If you all will help me, we can demonstrate the prevalence of apprenticeship in our organization. Are y'all listening? All right. If you have been mentored by an older, more experienced blind person in the Federation, say aye.
Aye.
All right. If you have mentored a younger, less experienced blind person who was just entering the Federation, say aye.
Aye.
All right. That's our community of practice all over this banquet hall and all over the country. My first mentor in the Federation was Dr. Larry Streeter, who is unfortunately no longer with us. That's right. Give it up for Dr. Streeter. Today, I am mentored by numerous people in the Federation, including President Rick Abono. Just as more experienced blind people mentor me, I in turn mentor the young blind students who walk into my classroom or bump into me out in the world. That's how a community of practice works. That's how the Federation works, and that's why this organization is such a powerful resource for blind students of all ages. As you listen to the other speakers on this panel today, take note of how our community of practice is referenced both explicitly and implicitly. All of the speakers on this panel have participated in one way or another in our National Center for Blind Youth and Science programs, which are currently funded by a grant from the National Science Foundation. This three-year grant is comprised of three intertwined components. The first component are our regional STEM programs called NFB STEM to You, which serve blind students, parents of blind children, and teachers of the blind. The second component is NFB EQ, a week-long advanced engineering program for blind high school students. The third and final component involves working with six science museums across the country to increase accessibility for blind visitors. Today, our speakers represent each of those three components of the grant. Our first speaker is Dr. Joseph Heimlich, the Executive Director of the Center for Research and Evaluation at COSI and the Principal Researcher at Lifelong Learning Group. Dr. Heimlich has donned many hats as a part of this project. He's been a great advisor with respect to navigating the museum world, and he's been a tremendous resource as our external evaluator, giving us advice about how to make our programming even more effective. Here's Dr. Heimlich.
Thank you, Natalie. As President Rick Abono said yesterday, this program is exciting. It's innovative and it's powerful. My role and my team's role in this project is a fun one. We get to help the National Federation of the Blind succeed. Our goal, our role, is to make sure that the good programs get even better and that we can give critical feedback and watch how Natalie and her team turn that into better and better programming for the benefit of the youth. There are several things we've learned, a lot we've learned in this project. Three, one of them is that these programs are working. They're working for the youth, they're working for the parents, they're working for the educators, and they're working for the museums. One major learning is that NFB is strongly committed to STEM learning. And this is important for the National Science Foundation. And finally, we're learning that parents want and need tools to help their children do science at home. So I want to take just a moment and make you do some work for me. I want you to take 1 minute and talk to the people next to you and identify three reasons you think these programs are important. You've got 1 minute. Go. I said go. You have 10 seconds. All right. So, what are some of the reasons these kinds of programs are important? Shout them out. Equity. Education, shout loud, I'm deaf. Yes. Career choices, problem solving, equity. Raising expectations, absolutely. These programs are doing all of those things and more. Oh man, that's a big one. Learning about themselves and who they are. What we are seeing, number one thing we're seeing is an increase in confidence in the youth. A discovery of what they can do and how they can do it and how they can be engaged in making their own decisions for the future. A second is an exposure to skills. They've not been given, in many cases, the opportunities to manipulate, to learn tactily and haptically around these very issues. And finally, they're receiving tools to help them perform in the classroom and beyond. Most STEM we learn, and almost all the STEM, science, technology, education, and mathematics we use, we do not use in the classroom. We use them in daily life. This means that museums and other informal organizations also need the support to work with youth who are blind and blind adults. This program is taking the traditional educational approaches used in blind education into museums and beyond, where we're seeing a transformation. The reason is that access and accessibility is the real issue for a lot of these youth and science. We're seeing that these are amazing young people who really need the opportunity to succeed. And this program and programs like this in the future will continue to give them opportunities to succeed.
Thanks, Dr. Heimlich. Next up is Ariana Benali, one of our younger students. She participated in two NFB STEM2U programs. At NFB STEM2U Phoenix, Ari told me that she was writing a story about our program for her school newspaper. Now she's going to share her story with us. Let's give it up for Ari.
Right.
Hello, my name is Ariana Benali. I'm 11 years old and going into the sixth grade. I went to two NFB STEM2U programs. STEM means science, technology, engineering, and math. We did a lot of engineering. Engineering taught us to make something new with recyclables. It inspired us to build and imagine. At the NFB STEM2U program in Columbus, Ohio, the museum was called COSI. COSI has exhibits about the human body, the ocean, and electricity. One exhibit was about a timeline when we did not have any electricity until present day, when we have a lot of electricity. The COSI was a lot of fun. I met a lot of kids from Columbus, and we Bigfoot built many projects together. We built racers, brush bots, and a flashcard tower. I learned that even though a person is visually impaired or blind, they can still build anything. I also learned how to work in a group. With our parents, we tried to build the tallest tower out of big blue blocks. My group won. These activities helped me learn more about STEM. At the NFB STEM2 program in Phoenix, Arizona, the museum was called the Arizona Science Center. That museum has exhibits about the human body. One exhibit was about a woman having a baby. Another exhibit was about the wind. In that exhibit, you had to stand on a platform and you could feel the wind and see the lightning. The Arizona Science Center was interesting. We built racers and a flashcard tower. Making these things made me use my creativity. We also played with the big blue blocks. We pretended to build a machine. It was fun and imaginative. With our parents, we learned how the digestive system works. The museum brought out a bowl with food in it. We smashed the food with a potato smasher, which was like our teeth chews. Then we put the smashed food in a plastic baggie, which was like our stomach. The museum brought out tubes that were the same size as our small and large intestines. We got to look at them. Finally, we learned about what happens to our food after we digest it. It was gross. The program was fun, creative, and it helped me understand that I can do and accomplish anything, even though that I am blind. So, there you have it. Now you know that the NFB STEM2U program is great for children and their parents. Blind people can accomplish anything. It is great to be connected with the National Federation of the Blind because their programs help us live the life we want.
All right. Yay! Great job.
Thanks, Ari. Frances Hammond is Ariana's mother, a board member of the National Organization of Parents of Blind Children, and an NFB STEM2U parent participant. Frances is going to tell us what it was like to be a parent at the program. Here's Frances.
Thank you, Natalie. My 11-year-old daughter, Ariana, and I live in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We have been members of the NFB of New Mexico since 2012. And since then, I have been in awe over the amazing work you have been doing to support each other and blind adults and children across the country. With the support of the NFB, our NFB of New Mexico, our Parents of Blind Children of New Mexico, we were given the opportunity to attend two of the NFB STEM2U programs. We attended the program in Columbus, Ohio, at the Center of Science and Industry in May of 2015, and we attended the Phoenix, Arizona program at the Arizona Science Center in November of 2015. I learned leaps and bounds about how to make science, technology, engineering, and math more accessible for Ariana. I tried to make our attendance at the Columbus program a learning experience from the beginning because Ariana and I had never been to Ohio before and we had never traveled alone with each other before. I let her guide me through the airports, which she quickly found is not always an easy task. She found out that rather than roam around aimlessly to read signs too small for her to read, she had to ask for help. This was a big step for her. Then we had our first ride in an Uber. These small, simple transportation details are steps that Ariana had never taken before. We were learning leaps and bounds, and we had not even arrived at the NFB STEM2U program yet. When we arrived at the hotel for the program, we met our facilitators and other parents and children from across the country who, like us, were searching for ways to make the STEM fields more accessible for our blind children. We all came from very different experiences in regards to our children's education. Over the course of the next couple of days, I heard about instances where services for blind students were extremely limited and examples of technology not being accessible to blind students. I learned that it is a struggle for our students to be as proficient as their sighted peers simply because of accessibility issues. I also learned how blessed Ariana has been to have blind teachers who are NFB members for 4 of the 5 years she was in elementary school. The NFB and the NFB philosophy make a difference in accessibility for our children. At the Columbus program, we learned about advocacy and what tools are available to blind children in the STEM fields. We talked about our children's individualized education plan, an IEP, and how much of an impact they have on a child's education. We were given a crash course on ways to make tools in the STEM fields more accessible. We learned about how to use tactile calipers and how to tactily mark a plastic milliliter syringe for measuring. We were shown an audio pen book combination that could read the periodic table and all of the information it displays. Dr. Kerry Sapalo showed us his wonderful talking lab quest that makes taking measurements in a scientific setting as accessible can be. I was surprised that I had never even heard of any of these tools before, and I was grateful that the NFB had put the STEM2U program together to help us sighted parents understand more about accessibility issues. Before the program, I thought I had a good understanding of what Ariana needed, but I was amazed at the wealth of information I had received. After the program, Ariana and I went home with a new outlook on what Ariana's education would look like. I started wondering about her future. Then we heard about another NFB STEM2U program much closer to home in Phoenix. I was overjoyed because the proximity meant my husband Bryce could attend. I had originally planned for him to take her alone, but I could not resist another weekend of attending an NFB program. After all, this is why we are Federationists. We were able to drive to Phoenix, and upon our arrival, I was expecting the program to mirror the Columbus program. I was excited to learn that a fellow National Organization of Parents of Blind Children board member, Pat Renfrans, and her husband Dave had come to facilitate most of the parents' activities. Pat and Dave are scientists, and learning from them was a much different experience because they have a deeper understanding of the STEM fields. Bryce and I were in for a long weekend of learning. For this program, we were asked to bring Ariana's latest IEP. We talked about IEP advocacy, and then we really delved into the IEP and what should be in it. We were told to highlight words like technology, science, math, and measure. Our IEP was the most highlighted in the whole room. This meant that our IEP team must be doing a good job, but there were other IEPs that were less than adequate. I am thankful that the NFB shed light on this problem through the STEM2U program. Now there were so many more informed parents out there who can more effectively advocate for their child's educational needs. As the program continued, I once again found myself with inadequate knowledge on how to make things more accessible for Ariana. Pat and Dave gave us specific examples of how to make science more accessible. I had never considered how to explain lunar cycles, the relative size of planets in our solar system, or the distance between planets to my daughter. Pat and Dave showed us how. We used a very long piece of string and beads to show the relative distances between planets. Using this method, it was easy to deduce that Mercury, Venus, and Earth are much closer in distance than Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Then we were paired in teams of two to tour the Arizona Science Center, armed with different tools to make the museum more accessible to our blind children. At each exhibit, one partner would wear a sleep shade while their partner would explain the exhibit to them while using some of the tools to make it more tactily accessible. One of the tools we found most useful was a sensational blackboard. We were able to use it to sketch a tactile representation of an exhibit. Bryce and I took turns. We learned more about the dynamics of helping our daughter get the most out of future trips to museums than we had ever before. The NFB STEM2U programs educated us on the importance of making the STEM fields more accessible for Ariana to succeed in her future educational endeavors. I am thankful that the NFB shared with us how to approach accessibility issues within the STEM fields. Now I know that even though she has had great NFB teachers, I still need to raise my expectations of her educational needs in the future. This coming year, Ariana will not be assigned a full-time teacher of the visually impaired because she is starting middle school. All of her teachers will be sighted. I'm worried about how they will help make things accessible for Ariana, but I know that I can help where they lack. The NFB STEM2U program has given us knowledge that we would not have obtained otherwise. Thank you, NFB, for providing a program that empowers parents with the knowledge to help their children succeed in the future.
Thanks, Francis. Cricket Beidelman was an apprentice in our NFB STEM2 San Francisco program and a participant in NFB EQ 2015. She is going to share her NFB EQ experience. Here's Cricket.
All right, Cricket.
Good morning, fellow Federationists.
Good morning.
I'm Cricket Beidelman, a 12th grader from Morro Bay, California. And I'm incredibly honored to have the opportunity to share my experiences with the National Center for Blind Youth and Science Initiative regarding the National Federation of the Blind Engineering Quotient Program. A man named Edward Prescott once said, "The only man who can change his mind is a man who's got one." This is true, but how much impact can just changing one's mind really have? Before ninth grade, I thought about a career in law. Since then, however, and no offense to the lawyers out there, I wanted to go into science, technology, engineering, or mathematics, also known as STEM. The only problem was that I didn't think such a career would be practical due to my blindness. That all changed after I attended NFB EQ. After arriving at the Jernigan Institute, having flown independently for the first time, I met 19 other blind high schoolers. I was then assigned to a team with three other students. After everyone had been split into teams, each group was given a marshmallow, dry spaghetti noodles, a paper bag, string, and a piece of tape. We were all challenged to make the tallest structure possible, using only the materials we had. My group taped the tips of our canes to the ground in a square, then stood them all upright, and tied the paper bag over the handles to keep them together. Imagine like a square pyramid kind of shape. Then we put the marshmallow on top and waited for the verdict. Though we did stretch the rules just a little, our creativity had allowed us to make the tallest structure using only the materials we had. I do want to point out that no one said anything about using only the materials we were given. The next day, we began our project, which took 4 days to complete. Each group constructed a boat out of oars and PVC pipes, wood, a tarp, and duct tape. And they weren't those little model boats that people put on shelves and forget about. We learned safety techniques for using drills, saws, and other tools. We also learned to make charcoal water filters out of recyclable materials, and each group was responsible for designing their own filter. At the end of the week, we raced the boats in a nearby reservoir. Thankfully, all of them floated. And although my team did not win the race, we did our best and learned a lot about engineering the process. And in the end, we won the award for the best filter design. Hey. The NFB EQ program taught me a lot. I learned independent travel skills by navigating multiple airports. I learned about the engineering process, about water filtration, and about how to use sharp tools safely. Most of all, the program developed my passion for the STEM field. As I mentioned earlier, Edward Prescott once said, "The only man who can change his mind is a man who's got one." I changed my mind in ninth grade, and am now interested in going to some area of the STEM field. However, just changing my mind was not enough. At the National Federation of the Blind Engineering Quotient Program, I was able to gain the experience that allowed me to realize that science is a practical career for me, and that with certain techniques, I can be just as independent as my sighted peers. In other words, NFB EQ taught me that I can live the life I want. Thank you, NFB. There's more. Science, technology, engineering, and math is so much more than numbers and equations. STEM is sharing how each person's individual perspective allows them to see and explain the world differently. As a blind person, I definitely see things differently. And thanks to NFB EQ, I now have the courage to share my perspective. And this is why we need more programs like NFB EQ, to inspire blind youth to pursue careers in STEM and to give young blind people the confidence and skills to share their perspective with the world. Thank you.
How about that? Thanks, Cricket. Salvia just participated in NFBEQ 2016. He's got some friends in the audience. And he was an apprentice at NFB STEMTU Phoenix. Sal's going to tell you what it was like to be an apprentice at NFB STEMTU.
Good morning, my Federation family. How are y'all doing this morning? My name is Salvador Villa, but everybody calls me Sal. I am from McAllen, Texas, and I will be a senior in high school this upcoming August. Last fall, I participated in the NFB STEMTU program. At the program, I learned leadership skills, had the opportunity to mentor younger students, make friends from different parts of the country, and travel across the country to new places. The aspect of the program that was most meaningful to me was being an apprentice at my regional program in Phoenix, Arizona. I enjoyed this part of the program the most because I was able to use the leadership skills I have gained from working at the NFB of Texas Bell Academy and put into practice the new skills I learned at the NFB STEMTU Leadership Academy in Baltimore. When I was a kid, many people helped me and mentored me, and being an apprentice at STEMTU allowed me to finally give back to my community. To me, nothing feels better than watching a child be successful and reach their goals, and NFB STEMTU gave me a firsthand experience of this feeling. In this program, I was in charge of a small group of children, and my job was to mentor them as they learned about science. I remember teaching them different cane skills as we walked around the museums looking at exhibits they were interested in. I was also able to share my story on what I have done in order to reach my goals and give them advice on what they can do in order to reach their own goals. I am thankful and grateful that I was given the privilege to be a part of NFB STEMTU, and I hope that other teenagers like me can have the same experience I had last November. Yo, this one goes out to the NFB of Texas, my mentors Daniel Martinez, Michael Osmond, and Jared Nyland. Check it. November 5th through 8th, 2015, Phoenix, Arizona was the place to be. I was an apprentice at STEMTU. Mentoring young blind children was all I had to do. Mentoring was successful while together. They thanked me for everything and I couldn't have felt better. Making wine glasses ring was pretty cool. I say it's like jumping into an ice cold pool. We learned about fossils and the anatomy of starfish. I remember someone said that they smelled like their goldfish. Walking with their canes and looking at exhibits, I remember telling them that the sky is the limit. Not everything was all fun and games. Eventually, leadership came into play. Thank you.
How about these kids? Our last presentation is a virtual presentation of sorts. We had participants in all of our NCBYS programs send in tweets about their experience, and we collected a selection of them to share with you today. Here is our spoof on the Jimmy Kimmel skit, Celebrities Read Mean Tweets.
Read NCBYS tweets.
At Curious Kid says, at the Museum of Science in hashtag Boston, I picked fake boogers out of a really huge model of a nose in the Hall of Human Life. Smiley face. Hashtag yucky, absolutely. Hashtag STEM. At Proud Mama, that's a great handle, says, overheard my son saying, I want to be more independent at home. Big mistake, kid. That spoke volumes to me. I'm sure it did. Hashtag grateful. Hashtag awesome opportunity. Hashtag NCBYS. And I'll add hashtag now you'll have to make up your bed all by yourself all the time. Good luck.
And scientist Sarah says, I asked a child at NFB STEMTU hashtag be more to watch the experiment. Quote, don't forget, I'm blind. At Apprentice STEMTU says, piano keys on the floor? Do re mi, give me more. Hashtag science museum, hashtag NCBYS. At AOTS says, favorite overheard. Hashtag exploratorium, hashtag STEM to you moment. Quote, I'm having so much fun. I'm forgetting about growing up. Does this make you forget about growing up?
At AlleyCat13 says, dissecting starfish was amazingly spongy. At Arizona Science Museum, hashtag NCBYS, hashtag STEM to you. I just learned something. Starfish are spongy. At Duct Tape King says, I use 10 million rolls of hashtag duct tape to build my boat. At NFBEQ, hashtag engineering, hashtag STEM. Hopefully that was an over-exaggeration of the amount of duct tape.
Patriot Fan 29 says, all the boats floated. Hashtag, we did it. Hashtag, oh snap. Hashtag, we are awesome. At NL Shaheen says, 2 years, 6 states, 11 programs, 400 participants, students, parents, teachers, hundreds of volunteers, one awesome at NFB underscore voice team. Hashtag, time for a nap. At Riccobono says, great job at NFB underscore voice. Hashtag, what's next?
In closing, I would like to thank each and every one of you for making our education programs possible. Everyone in this room contributes to our community of practice, and without that community of practice, our education programs would not be successful. So pat yourselves on the back and give your neighbor a high five. Together with love, hope, and determination, we transform young blind students' dreams into reality. Thank you.
Thanks, Natalie. Thank you, Natalie, and our STEM to You participants.
Leave a legacy. For more than 75 years, the National Federation of the Blind has worked to transform the dreams of hundreds of thousands of blind people into reality, and with your support, we will continue to do so for decades to come. We sincerely hope that you will plan to be part of our enduring movement by adding the National Federation of the Blind as a partial beneficiary in your will. A gift to the National Federation of the Blind in your will is more than just a charitable, tax-deductible donation. It is a way to join in the work to help blind people live the lives they want that leaves a lasting imprint on the lives of thousands of blind children and adults. With your help, the NFB will continue to give blind children the gift of literacy through Braille, promote the independent travel of the blind by providing free, long white canes to blind people in need, develop dynamic educational projects and programs that show blind youth that science and math are within their reach, deliver hundreds of accessible newspapers and magazines to provide blind people the essential information necessary to be actively involved in their communities, offer aids and appliances that help seniors losing vision maintain their independence, and fund scholarship programs so that blind students can achieve their dreams. Plan to leave a legacy. Creating a will gives you the final say in what happens to your possessions and is the only way to be sure that your remaining assets are distributed according to your passions and beliefs. Many people fear creating a will or believe it's not necessary until they are much older. Others think that it's expensive and confusing. However, it is one of the most important things you will do, and with new online legal programs, it is easier and cheaper than ever before. If you do decide to create or revise your will, consider the National Federation of the Blind as a partial beneficiary. Visit www.nfb.org/planned-giving or call 410-659-9314 extension 2371 for more information. Together with love, hope, determination, and your support, we will continue to transform dreams into reality. Participating in the American Dream means paying taxes. The Innovation of Accessible Financial Tools at H&R Block by Brett Reimer. There is a photo on the page, the caption, Brett Reimer. From the editor. Paying taxes is not something many of us are excited about doing, but the experience is frustrating enough without the added stress of being unable to do so because of the technology used in preparing the forms that report income, deductions, and the bottom line number that will reveal whether we pay more into the system or get some back. H&R Block is a leader in tax preparation, providing human assistance for those who wish to pay for it and computerized assistance for those who do not. It was Mr. Reimer's challenge to follow Jordan Castor on the agenda, and those who have read her remarks will understand why he began his presentation by acknowledging hers. But before we get to his remarks, here's what President Riccobono said in introducing Mr. Reimer. This is an important agenda item because getting access to the tools that are needed to file our taxes and independently manage our finances is an important topic, and over the last few years, with our work, H&R Block has come to be a model in moving accessibility within an organization. Here to talk to us about the work of H&R Block, where, over the last year, 23 million people have filed their taxes online, is the Director of Technology who leads a team of accessibility experts in changing the paradigm of accessibility and improving the tools at H&R Block. Here is Brett Reimer.
So, Jordan, this is going to be a tough act to follow. My gosh. Great story. But on behalf of H&R Block, congratulations on another successful convention and all the outstanding work that you've done this past year to make the world a more accessible place. I personally want to thank the organizers of this conference for inviting me to speak today. This has just been a tremendous personal opportunity for me to be here over the past couple of days. I've really enjoyed speaking with a few of you, listening, learning a lot. I really enjoyed going to the exhibit hall and hearing about all of the amazing innovation that's going on. I mean, there is a lot of innovation going on, and it's just really exciting to be a part of that. I cannot wait to take that all back to Kansas City and bring back even more knowledge and enthusiasm back to H&R Block. This is the second year that H&R Block has been a part of this national convention. We were here last year for the world record-breaking umbrella mosaic. That was incredible. And as I was preparing for my speech today, it just really stuck out to me about what can be achieved when you really rally around a goal. And it was just an amazing accomplishment that you all made. And I really want to take that rally, that attitude towards accessibility into H&R Block. And I think that we've done that over the past few years. And we're very excited to continue to move forward with that. Now, I know I work for a tax company, and I may think taxes are the most interesting thing in the world. But that's probably not what you want to hear about today. My topic today is going to be all about innovation. It's going to be about how H&R Block over the past few years has been innovating and reinventing the way that we deliver products to market. We have integrated web accessibility into our product development lifecycle, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about the journey that we've been on for the past few years and how that's really come to life at H&R Block. So today, we've only got a short time, but I'm going to give you a brief overview of the history of H&R Block as well as what we do, and then take you along that journey that we've been on for the past few years. H&R Block really started out as an innovative company from the very beginning. They were founded in 1955 when Henry Block and Richard Block had a small bookkeeping business in downtown Kansas City. One day, a salesman from the Kansas City Star newspaper came to them and asked them if they ever thought about doing tax preparation for individuals. They talked about it a little bit and decided to run an ad in the Kansas City Star to offer tax preparation for $5. Literally, the next day, he had an office full of new clients, and they basically had invented the tax preparation industry. So you can see that we've started out as a very innovative startup company back in 1955. Fast forward all the way till today, we've done over 650 million returns. We have around 12,000 offices throughout the United States, and we typically have an office within five miles of every American. Not only do we have all those 12,000 offices, but we also have our do-it-yourself product suite. We have software that you can buy in the retail outlets. We have an online and mobile solution that you can go online to do your taxes yourself. And that's really what we're going to focus on discussing today. We're going to talk about how we're reinventing the way that we develop those online and mobile products to build in web accessibility from the very beginning. So our accessibility journey started a few years ago with a cooperative consent decree. Now, this may seem adversarial, but the relationship between H&R Block and the NFB has truly grown into a strategic partnership over the past several years. Now, there have been many people within your organization that have helped us achieve this, but there are a couple people that I want to acknowledge today. Carl Bellinger and Gary Wunder
have been instrumental in how we have formed our accessibility program. They have offered tremendous guidance, knowledge, and leadership over the past few years. Gary has actually helped recruit consultants from your organization that we have hired on to test and help guide us to make our products accessible. It's been a great partnership that we've formed through the past few years. So thank you, Carl and Gary. Now, we were really challenged with this challenge of web accessibility a few years ago, and the challenge was to bring our online tax product accessible by the next tax season. Now, this challenge seemed daunting. It really was going to take a team to rally around this idea and make it happen. And that first year was critical. What we did was we formed an accessibility program. We formed a program and a committee that not only defined process, but also act as champions, because we needed to integrate this knowledge and this enthusiasm throughout the entire company, because it really took a team effort and a company-wide effort. That also took partnerships with a third-party web accessibility consulting firm, as well as the NFB. So there are really three areas that this committee focuses on. I think about it in terms of training awareness, the software development lifecycle or product development lifecycle, and then the strategic planning and strategic partnerships that we make. So we've come a long way in the past 3 years. Like I mentioned, the first year was daunting. We came from a very reactionary organization to a much more proactive strategic organization in how we think about accessibility, and I'm going to walk you through that journey. The first is around training and awareness. Now, at the very beginning, we really focused on the technical training that was required. We had an existing website that was built over several years. We have literally thousands of web pages and forums to become compliant. We really focused our training efforts on how do we remediate what we have today and how do we test that. But we have broadened that significantly in the past 3 years. Now, our training efforts go all the way into our marketing organizations, our graphic design. We have moved this knowledge and education to the very beginning of our product development lifecycle, to where we are thinking about web accessibility from the very beginning. The other way that we think about training is our hands-on training. There are new industry standards, new expertises always coming out. One that we've really seen mature in the past couple of years is around mobile accessibility. So last year, we sent several of our developers out to California with our consulting firm, and we did a 3-day hands-on training session, working with our mobile apps, and coming out of that, we had many of the issues identified and many of them remediated by the time they came out of that. This was a tremendous opportunity for us to sit side by side, real users, understand their own client experience, and remediate those issues. The second area is around the software development lifecycle. Like I mentioned, we've brought web accessibility up to the very beginning of that lifecycle within how we design our products. We recently redesigned our tax estimator, which almost 10 million people use each year to estimate their refund. We redesigned that in a way where we thought about web accessibility. We had design reviews at the very beginning. We thought about color contrast, user experience, technical requirements. All of that was done up front. But after we move into the development stage of the product development lifecycle, we really have to make sure that all of the developers are developing in a consistent way. We have developed over the past 3 years a robust knowledge base. We have developed over 200 articles around how we develop at H&R Block. We've taken industry best practices, we've mapped those to very specific requirements for H&R Block design, and we have a robust knowledge base that each one of our developers can access. After we've developed the product, we move into the testing phase. Now, we not only functionally test our products now, we have to test for web accessibility. We do this in 3 different ways. The first one is around our automated testing. Over the past 3 years, we've formed a really robust automated testing solution in partnership with our consulting firm. We can not only test the new products that we're developing, but we can also regression test the rest of the products that we have as new industry standards and best practices come into play. The second way that we test is really around leveraging assisted technology at H&R Block. We use this to walk through the client experience and validate the product. The third way that we do this is, like I mentioned before, we're partnering with the NFB and others. We're reaching out and we're engaging with the user community and really trying to make an optimal user experience. The third way that our committee really reaches out is around our strategic planning and partnerships. We've been here, we were here, like I mentioned, we were here last year. We've also engaged with the CSUN conference as well. We sent numerous people there this past year, and these are just great opportunities to listen and hear from everyone. It's a great opportunity to understand what different vendors are doing to innovate. It's also a great opportunity for us to connect with other companies that are on their own web accessibility journey. It's an opportunity for us to hear from them and also let them know what we are doing within our organization. So, in conclusion, we have made tremendous progress over the past 3 years, but we are not done. This is something that does not start and stop. This is something that has to be integrated into the culture and all of the processes you have within product development. So we look forward to continuing to improve on our products. Once again, on behalf of H&R Block, thank you for inviting me to speak today. It's been a pleasure.
The Roots of the Federation in the World, the Isabel Grant Story in Her Own Words by Deborah Kent Stein. There is a photo on the page, the caption, Deborah Kent Stein. From the editor, Debbie Stein is an active member of the National Federation of the Blind who, like many of us, wears a number of hats. She is an officer in the National Federation of the Blind of Illinois, the chairman of its scholarship committee, a member of the National Scholarship Committee, and the editor of Future Reflections, our magazine for the parents of blind children. She is a well-known author of children's books, and she also makes great presentations, as can be seen from what follows.
I almost heard their eyebrows arch. The silence was so great. A blind woman going around the world? What would she see? Nothing. And where do you plan to go? Oh, to see the Acropolis, the Taj Mahal, the Angkor Wat, the Blue Mountains of Australia, the Maori huts of New Zealand, and perhaps a visit to the Fiji Islands if my money holds out. Going alone, India, what if a cobra jumps out at you? It would be a trifle late to do anything then. What if some pickpocket takes your purse with your passport and all your money? That would be more probable than the cobra jumping out at me, but I'm a match for any pickpocket. This excerpt from the first chapter of Dr. Isabel Grant's book, Crooked Paths Made Straight, gives you a taste of Isabel Grant's approach to life. She was one feisty lady. She did not fold up when people told her no. And she certainly didn't see blindness as a barrier. When she wanted to go somewhere and do something, she went there and she did it. I had the opportunity to edit Isabel Grant's memoir of her year-long sabbatical trip that she took around the world in 1959-1960. The manuscript had been donated to the NFB by her grandson. It had never been published. She wrote it in 1965. She died in 1977. So this was an opportunity to kind of try to channel her and figure out what she meant by some of her awkward sentences and her references. And thank goodness for Wikipedia, I looked up lots of people who she talked about who I'd never heard of before from all over the world. But The book is now out and available for people to read and to know something about Isabel and her amazing career. After teaching for 32 years in the Los Angeles school system, she retired and started a completely new career as an international ambassador, promoting opportunities for the blind in education and the workforce. And her achievements in the years that she carried on with this work were so outstanding that in 1972 she was nominated for the Nobel Prize for Peace. Isabel Grant was born fully sighted in a fishing village on the Scottish coast in 1896. In 1924, she and her husband emigrated to the United States, and they settled in Los Angeles, where she began her teaching career. She had a gift for languages, and she was fluent not only in English, but in French, Spanish, and German. In 1940, she earned a PhD in comparative literature from the University of Southern California. In 1946, Isabel's life changed dramatically. Her husband died, leaving her a widow with a teenage daughter, and at the same time, she developed acute glaucoma. She took a leave of absence from teaching to pursue medical treatments, but after 8 painful surgeries, she was totally blind by the fall of 1948. At that point, she sank into despair. She believed that she couldn't cook, couldn't sew, and she certainly couldn't teach. And the people around her were pretty quick to agree. She said later, "They treated me as though I had lost my wits as well as my eyesight." But finally, a friend took her to meet a man named James Garfield. And Garfield was a member of the California affiliate of the National Federation of the Blind. She arrived unannounced at Mr. Garfield's door, and in true Federation spirit, he invited her in. He listened to her story, and right on the spot, he began to mentor her. He urged her to learn Braille and to learn to use a long white cane, and he introduced her to Dr. Jacobus Tenbroek and his wife, Hazel, and the Tenbroeks became her lifelong friends. Dr. Grant was a very quick study. Within just a few months, she had mastered Braille, she had mastered cane travel, and she had done a total 180-degree turn in her attitude about blindness. She was ready to go back to work. But the Los Angeles schools had other ideas. There was an ordinance in Los Angeles County that said that in order to teach in the public schools, a teacher had to have a visual acuity of 20 over 70. So rather than inviting her back into the classroom, the school told her that she should retire on disability. However, her colleagues pitched in at that point. 63 teachers signed an impassioned letter demanding that she be retained in her teaching position. The superintendent had to give in, but there was a caveat. She would not be allowed to teach sighted students. She would only be allowed to teach blind children, an area in which she had absolutely no training or experience. However, she continued as a quick study, and the teaching of blind children very quickly became her passion. In 1956, Dr. Grant went on a trip to Norway to attend a conference on the instruction of blind students, and she discovered two things. She discovered that blindness need not stop her from traveling and enjoying it immensely, and she also learned about the enormous needs of blind children all over the world. She determined to travel more extensively and to learn about the blind of the rest of the world's nations. In 1959, she was eligible for a sabbatical, and she planned to take a solo trip around the world, the trip that she recounted in her memoir, Crooked Paths Made Straight. She visited 20 countries in the course of a year, beginning in Great Britain, and yes, her money did hold out long enough for her to get to the Fiji Islands. At that time, it was highly unusual for a woman to be traveling alone, blind or sighted. For a blind woman to do it was absolutely unheard of. But as she wrote, "I sallied forth from California, laden with enough impedimenta for one of Caesar's soldiers on the march across Gaul. My suitcase balanced the scale at 44 pounds, besides a sheaf of tickets, a thick passport, health records, and a fat book of traveler's checks." Does anybody remember what those were? "I carried a huge camel's hair coat and a velour hat. My typewriter, weighing 10 pounds, hung from my left arm." The more she traveled, the more impedimenta she accumulated. And throughout the book, she keeps telling us about the things that were added to her load. In Rome, Dr. Grant attended a meeting of the World Council for the Welfare of the Blind, which was an organization that had been founded in 1949. The World Council consisted mostly of professionals in the blindness field, and very few of those professionals were blind. Nearly all of the blind people present at this meeting were professionals from Europe and North America. Dr. Grant began to wonder, why weren't people from Africa and Asia, blind people from Africa and Asia and the Pacific Islands represented? She also was very disturbed to see that sighted professionals were speaking for the blind, deciding what the blind should do and what would be best for them. At that point, she had been a federation for almost 10 years, and she knew that blind people can make progress only when they speak for themselves. As she wrote, "I believe that self-acceptance, independence, and action, underwritten by equality of opportunity, are the birthright of all blind people, just as they are for the sighted." Of all the countries that she visited, the one that affected her the most deeply was Pakistan. And on that sabbatical trip, she actually spent 6 months in Karachi studying Urdu and beginning to teach teachers to work with blind students. She traveled the world until the end of her life in 1977, and Pakistan remained her adopted country, the country that she loved the most. She definitely found life in Pakistan to be a learning experience for her. She writes about traveling in a rickshaw. "I do not remember ever setting out on a journey without the rickshaw stalling." These were little motorized carts that were driven by a driver. She said, "The driver would jump out, pick up some formidable pieces of iron, and give a few hard knocks to the machine. On we went. Some rickshaw drivers took joy from their speed. They had no mercy on their fare. We rattled along, dipping into every pothole. At every dip, I bounced up into the canopy, and my head invariably bumped against the metal bar across the top. Hanging on grimly to the support bars at the side, I was like a ball bouncing around inside an iron cage." Everywhere she went, Dr. Grant made friends and influenced people. She was very social. She was not the least bit shy, and she talked with teachers, social workers, doctors, shop owners, government workers, and beggars in the street. Always, she talked about the untapped potential of blind people, the contributions they could make in their native countries if only they were given the chance. She had boundless warmth and generosity of spirit, but she was not afraid to speak her mind when someone disagreed with her. At one point, the director of an agency for the blind in Uganda asked her how he could improve his programs, and she wrote to him, "I find your plans admirably ambitious and comprehensive, but they are still of the old custodial care type, planning things for the blind. And as I see it, doing or trying to do something better, which should not be done at all." She always felt that the key to developing blind people's potential was education. And she knew that education was not possible without books. When she was in the United States after her travels, or in between travels, Dr. Grant launched a project to send used Braille books to individuals in schools overseas. She started by sending books to Pakistan, and soon she was sending books to other countries as well. She organized federations across the United States to send used books to her. And then she and a team of volunteers packed the books into 15-pound cartons and shipped them all over the world, along with slates and styluses, Braille paper, Perkins Braillers, anything that might be of use to blind students overseas. She also helped students find scholarships and helped many to come to the United States to study so that they could return to their home countries and continue teaching. She always encouraged her students to persevere despite every obstacle. And through all of her contacts overseas, she constantly searched for potential leaders, for people who could develop organizations overseas modeled on the NFB. During the 1960s and 1970s, she traveled almost constantly. One time when she was about to set off, Dr. Tenbroek said to her, "I feel like you're a great eagle flying off alone into the world." And she replied, "No, I'm not alone, for I have always the Federation behind me." In 1964, Dr. Grant helped found the International Federation of the Blind, and Dr. Tenbroek served as its president until his death in 1968. Dr. Grant was the treasurer of the IFB, and she also edited its quarterly newsletter, which was published in English, French, Spanish, and German. Crooked Paths Made Straight and Dr. Grant's other writings are filled with stories of Isabel Grant's travels and adventures. She did encounter a pickpocket who managed to steal some cash on a Paris street but didn't get his hands on her papers. And while she was visiting a school in the Congo, a teacher screamed, "Jump!" And she didn't ask questions. She jumped and avoided stepping on a cobra. Her legacy can be found in the lives and work of thousands of blind women and men who learned from the books that she put into their hands, who absorbed her ideas and were inspired by her passion, and who went on to mentor the next generation. Nearly 40 years after her death, blind people in India and Pakistan, Kenya and Ethiopia, and dozens of other countries are studying and working, following in the paths that Isabel Grant made straight for them.
From the editor, Crooked Paths Made Straight is available to purchase in EPUB or PDF from iUniverse, Kindle, and the Apple Store from iBooks. It is available in standard print from Amazon and from the NFB Independence Market. Eliminating Artificial Barriers, Civil Rights and Disability at the United States Department of Justice by Eve Hill. There is a photo on the page, the caption, Eve Hill. From the editor, it is no accident that Eve Hill has become an annual fixture on the National Federation of the Blind's annual agenda. She is passionate, articulate, and informed. She is able to communicate all of these, and for this reason it is always our pleasure to put her remarks in the pages of the Braille Monitor. Here is what she said to the 2016 National Convention.
This next item is an important one. It's Eliminating Artificial Barriers, Civil Rights and Disability at the United States Department of Justice. To deliver this item, we have the Deputy Assistant Attorney General, Civil Rights Division for the United States Department of Justice, a true advocate in her own right, and a friend of the National Federation of the Blind. Here's Eve Hill.
This is my fight song. Take back my life song. Prove I'm all right song.
I like the song. So, good afternoon and thank you. And thank you, President Riccobono, for that really nice introduction and for your work at making NFB such an impactful and powerful organization, and for all of you for contributing to that. For decades, NFB has brought stakeholders together to safeguard justice, advance opportunity, and defend the rights of blind people. And in doing so, you help blind people live meaningful, enjoyable, productive lives. You enable our communities to reach their full potential. You advance America's founding dream as the land of equal opportunity. And you make the promise of our laws a reality for everybody. Now, President Riccobono told me that they saved some space in the agenda for friends of NFB and for fresh meat. He didn't say which one I was. So I'm very glad that he introduced me as a friend of NFB. And if there's a French fresh meat section, I'm going to save it for the end, because he also told me I had 4 minutes less than I planned on. Ha-ha. So not that long ago, for blind people and people with other disabilities, this dream and this promise of America, the land of equal opportunity, felt really distant and out of reach. Discrimination was often built into our laws and into our public services, and because those laws and service systems were based on faulty assumptions about the capabilities of people with disabilities, they made those mistaken assumptions into self-fulfilling prophecies. But the beauty of America's story and the promise of its legal framework shows us that we, as a country and as a people, can change. We can progress, not always perfectly, but unyieldingly. As Dr. Maurer used to say, we don't lose the war because we don't stop fighting. And we can pass new laws and enforce the ones we want, we already have, to make sure the freedoms our Constitution guarantees and the opportunities that all people deserve are actually reached by everyone. So the arc of our nation's progress in the disability rights arena highlights this. In the 1960s and 70s around the country, the exposure of the inhumane treatment in institutions sparked public outrage. Outrage fueled advocacy, and over time, advocacy drove legal change, resulting in part in our 1999 decision by the Supreme Court in Olmstead versus LC that segregation of people with disabilities is discrimination. But of course, laws and rulings alone don't vindicate rights. People do. People like you, organizations like NFB, and organizations like the Justice Department, particularly, I'd say, the Civil Rights Division. And we all know, unfortunately, that there's a lot of tough and really important and urgent work that lies ahead to vindicate those rights. Even 17 years after the Olmstead decision and more than 25 years after the enactment of the Americans with Disabilities Act, far too many people with disabilities continue to see a real gap between what the law promises on the one hand and what people really experience on the other. We see this gap in transportation, as people with disabilities face unlawful barriers when traveling to work or on a plane, as we heard earlier, barriers to vacationing with their families, areas where the Justice Department has tried to take on these issues aggressively, including from Amtrak's rail stations to Greyhound's bus fleet, where I must note we have secured an uncapped damages fund where if you have been treated badly by Greyhound because of a disability, you should be filing a complaint through this process, and all the way to Carnival's cruise ships. We see this gap in the electoral process. Too many people with disabilities trying to participate in our democracy find themselves turned away by unnecessary barriers to a private and independent vote. And through the ADA voting initiative, the department continues to address these barriers with open investigations of polling places, voting, registration, and ballot accessibility all around the country. We see this gap in employment as 450,000 people with disabilities spend their time in segregated sheltered workshops or day programs, with some paid just pennies an hour. And we see this gap in technology as new technologies are developed and older technologies, I must say the websites are now an older technology, as these are deployed and rolled out in ways that don't include people with disabilities and thus exclude them even more than the old paper and pen world did. We see this gap in education as schools deny children with disabilities the opportunities they deserve to learn and thrive alongside their non-disabled peers. And we see this gap in the justice system as too many people suffer from policies that criminalize mental illness and other disabilities. Right now I'm reading this new book. I was reading it on the plane. It's called The Boys in the Bunkhouse, which chronicles the story of the men with disabilities in Adelissa, Iowa, who worked for decades for Henry's Turkey Service for $65 a month and lived in an abandoned schoolhouse where cockroaches infested the kitchen, the heater didn't work, and the fire doors were padlocked shut. And that story demonstrates the many ways institutions can ruin people's lives by separating them from their families, by putting a profit motive on their care, by making them outsiders, someone else's responsibility to their neighbors, and by taking away choice and the ability to grow and learn. And that story also highlights the people who tried to raise the alarm and were thwarted by bureaucratic silos and pretty lies, and such an ingrained assumption that the men there were so different from the rest of us that it just wasn't even necessary to ask them about their experience. It makes me furiously angry and inconsolably sad. And even after the lawsuits by the heroic Robert Canino of the EEOC, you may not think of government lawyers as heroic, but some of them are, and he's one of them. And even after the rescue and resettlement of those men, it's still not right. Many of them have been moved to nursing homes in Texas because they were given no other choice. None of them have gotten the damages, $240 million in damages, that the jury awarded them, because the money is gone. And those damages were awarded not for back pay alone, but for the loss of enjoyment of life for decades. And that strikes me as the real harm from institutionalization. It's not okay. It has to stop. I have to stop it. We all have to stop it. So, in partnership with many of you here today, the Justice Department works to make sure that people with disabilities, our friends, our families, our neighbors, our colleagues, can live and work and learn in their own communities with everyone else. For the last 8 years, the Obama administration, in partnership with you, has led vigorous Olmstead enforcement efforts that breathe new meaning and real life into the Supreme Court's findings. Since 2009, we've taken action and filed briefs in 50 Olmstead integration matters in 25 states. And because of our Olmstead work, today more than 53,000 people with disabilities, 53,000 people, will have meaningful opportunities to receive services in integrated community-based settings that they choose. In Oregon and Rhode Island, in the past 3 years, the department's enforcement efforts have led to statewide commitments to transform their employment services systems from ones that enforce the tyranny of low expectations in sheltered workshops to ones that support people with disabilities to pursue their goals and their dreams in real jobs at real wages in their communities. And throughout our Olmsted work, we see close connections between barriers to education and limited opportunities in employment and other aspects of life. When students capable of learning in integrated classrooms don't get the opportunity to do so, they just don't get access to the full set of skills, resources, and experience they need to reach their potential in the classroom, in the workforce, or in life. Last year, the Justice Department took on the unnecessary segregation of students with behavior-related disabilities in so-called special schools in Georgia. Our letter of findings about the Georgia Network for Educational and Therapeutic Support, GNETS, makes clear that the ADA prohibits states from unnecessarily placing students with behavior-related disabilities in separate and unequal. Some of these were the black schools from the days of legal segregation of schools. They cannot put them in those separate schools when they can learn in regular education settings. And our Olmsted community integration efforts span an array of areas. Last month, we released findings that South Dakota unnecessarily relies on nursing facilities to provide services for people with disabilities of all ages. Thousands of people who rely on South Dakota for their services must live in nursing facilities in order to receive those services, isolated from their communities, often surrounded by people with very little in common with them. For example, one of the people we spoke to is a 77-year-old man with diabetes, who's lost his vision and went to a nursing home after a toe amputation. All he needed was some help to check his feet regularly. He's been living in an institution for 5 years. As part of our efforts in this area to address the rights of people with disabilities to live in their communities, under the leadership of the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General, we launched a new initiative just recently to look at the interaction between mental health and the criminal justice system. Because make no mistake, the community integration mandate in Olmsted applies not just to some, but to all public entities. That includes the public entities in our criminal justice system. And the Justice Department's efforts in this space focus on four key areas. On the streets, we want police officers to de-escalate tense encounters with people with disabilities and reduce the need to use force. In our courts, where appropriate, we want to divert individuals with mental illness from incarceration and connect them with community-based services. In our jails and prisons, we want to ensure that people get connected with the services they need to successfully reintegrate into their communities and stay there. And in order for the criminal justice entities to meet their obligations and address the needs of the whole community, states and localities need to meet their ADA obligations to provide community-based services. We cannot truly achieve fair and smart criminal justice reform until criminal justice entities and local jurisdictions fulfill their Olmsted obligations. So, we have recently, in a number of settlement agreements in Portland and Seattle and Cleveland and in Hinds County, gotten these jurisdictions to interact with their local mental health systems and with people with disabilities in their communities. In addition to working on de-escalation and crisis intervention programs, these jurisdictions have created committees to advise them on how to better keep these silos interacting in ways that get people to the right services instead of into a jail where they won't get them. We're also focusing our efforts on ensuring that people with disabilities have full access to all the basic activities that people without disabilities take for granted and that form the basis for enjoyment of life. from parenting to learning to using the internet to do whatever you want and whatever you can afford when and where you want it, including at home in your bunny slippers. It's the way I do it. So, but let's start with parenting. We recently made a finding that the state of Massachusetts discriminated against a parent with a disability by taking her child away from her in the hospital and failing to provide the full range of reunification services it offers to everybody, and by failing to provide reasonable modifications in those services specifically to accommodate her disability. That state kept that child away from her mother for 2 years. But recognizing that this was happening all across the country, last year we and the Department of Health and Human Services issued a technical assistance document entitled Protecting the Rights of Parents and Prospective Parents with Disabilities. That document makes clear that the ADA applies to child welfare agencies and courts making decisions about child custody and placement, neglect, and abuse. The ADA prohibits these agencies from basing their decisions on incorrect stereotypes about people with disabilities, requires them to provide reasonable modifications to their policies when needed to allow a parent with a disability to fully participate. And it challenges the stereotypical assumptions that child welfare agencies have too often made about parents with disabilities and requires people with disabilities to be treated as the individuals they are. Hey. Now, technology. We are becoming more and more a technology-dependent society. And we at DOJ are enforcing the ADA in ways that ensure that technology is designed and implemented so it actually achieves equally effective communication for people with disabilities, both in educational institutions and everywhere. And we've been enforcing the ADA requirements for accessible instructional technology and content against educational institutions and others since 2010, when the NFB said, hey, what about these six colleges that are implementing an inaccessible ebook reader that I won't name? I could, but I won't. We reached agreement with those six colleges. I'm in there somewhere. Not necessarily where I am now, that required them to agree not to purchase, require, or use inaccessible ebook readers. And to ensure that a student who is blind or has low vision can acquire the same information, engage in the same interactions, and enjoy the same services as sighted students with substantially equivalent ease of use, and you can thank Dan Goldstein for that standard. And we in the Department of Education followed that with Dear Colleague letters to colleges, universities, and elementary and secondary schools saying that the use of inaccessible emergency technologies in the classroom violates the ADA. We also followed that with a settlement agreement with the Sacramento Public Library, which had purchased a bunch of inaccessible Nook ebook readers to lend to its patrons. The settlement in that case requires them to buy at least 18 accessible ebook readers to lend. And web-based, even online-only instructional technology and content providers themselves have ADA obligations to make their services accessible if they offer them to the public. We've made clear that providers of educational and entertainment services online can be covered as public accommodations under Title III of the ADA. So we and NFB have also been enforcing the accessibility requirements against those entities. We've made that position clear against Netflix, who I'm sure was thrilled about that. We've reached agreements to make websites accessible with the Peapod Grocery Delivery Service and with H&R Block. And we've been very active in enforcing the ADA in the context of online education and instructional technology and content. In 2013, we reached a settlement agreement with Louisiana Tech University for using a version of an online learning product that was inaccessible. One blind student, was unable to get the course materials for a month into the university quarter, at which point he was so far behind he had to withdraw from the course. Under the settlement agreement, the university has to adopt a number of disability-related policies, including they have to require themselves to deploy learning technology, web pages, and course content that is accessible in accordance with WCAG 2.0 level AA, in all across the university setting. They'll make their existing web pages and materials created since 2010 accessible, and they'll pay that student $23,543 in damages. And then we get into MOOCs, massive open online courses. Last year we reached a settlement with edX, which operates a MOOC platform with content from 60 colleges and universities. Under that settlement, within 18 months, edX will make its website, mobile apps, learning management system all comply with WCAG 2.0 level AA. It will make sure its websites, apps, and LMS don't interfere with accessibility features of any content providers. Using WCAG, MathML, WCAG 2 ICT, ARIA, DAISY, and EPUB3. 18 months after that, edX will make its content management system accessible, WCAG 2.0 level AA, it's a theme. In future contracts with content providers, edX will notify them of accessibility requirements and encourage them to make their content accessible and require them to certify before they post content that it is accessible. And the big boys, Harvard and MIT, we filed a brief in a suit by the National Association of the Deaf challenging Harvard and MIT's failure to put captioning on their online videos and audio files. Our brief made clear that enforcement of the ADA's effective communication requirements does not need to wait for our rulemaking efforts to be completed. That has become more important than I thought it was. And we recently joined NFB in a suit against Miami University, which is still proceeding, about its failure to ensure its educational technologies are accessible. We've also focused on making accessibility of websites and technology part of all of our accessibility work. So our employment enforcement, we in the past year have incorporated making online job application and job testing materials systems accessible, with six local governments in the past year having agreed to do that. And we've made accessible websites a key component of every single one of our Project Civic Access compliance reviews of state and local governments. And that's just DOJ. The Department of Education has also been active. Just last week, they reached settlements with education organizations in seven states and one territory to make those websites accessible for people with disabilities. And honestly, we've been following on NFB's coattails in many of these actions, and I can't wait to hear from Jamie, who's really a hero to me. So am I done yet? Have I run out of time?
Oh, long ago.
Oh, darn. Well, then I can't go into the red meat part. We have not yet issued a rule. We have issued a supplemental advance notice of proposed rulemaking. Please tell us what you think. Be honest. I dare you. But we're going to continue to enforce the law that already requires that the communications of covered entities, including those communicated through technology, must be accessible. We don't need to wait for rulemaking, and we won't. So I continue to look forward to working to you. This is my favorite conference to come to. And thank you very much.
Educational Assessments, Math Innovations, and Real Accessibility, Progress at Pearson by John Twing. There is a photo on the page, the caption, John Twing. From the editor, getting a fair shake in education means the opportunity to learn, and often that opportunity is conditioned on how the blind do on standardized tests. Sometimes the blind have been forbidden from taking them, the argument being that any accommodations made to the test would invalidate it. Accommodations which have been opposed by the industry include putting the test in Braille, making it available so it can be read using a screen reader, or increasing print size so it can be viewed by those who rely primarily on remaining vision to read and write. One of the largest companies involved in creating and administering standardized tests is Pearson, so the progress we have made with them is significant. In his introduction, President Riccobono said that Pearson has taken accessibility so seriously that they have not only done what we have asked of them, but have worked hard to use their knowledge of test-taking to enhance the accessibility experience. Here is what John Twing has to say about his job, the value of testing, and the commitment he has to accessibility.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Federation. I am responsible for assessments at Pearson, so naturally I live in Iowa City, Iowa, that mecca of assessments. I'm glad to be here today to talk a little bit about some of our activities. I'm a trained test builder. I'm something the field calls a psychometrician. People often ask me, how do you choose such an occupation? And I have a little secret for you, with no disrespect intended to my good friend at H&R Block, but we all start out as accountants. And those of us with a sense of humor become psychometricians. I've been building assessments for over 35 years of all types and shapes, both domestically and internationally. So I have to be honest with you, if you don't enjoy assessments, it's probably my fault. There's not an assessment in North America that I haven't touched. I'm happy to talk to you about any concerns you might have. Just look up Jan McSorley or Sam Dooley or even Cricket, and they'll put you in touch with me. I'm going to be here the rest of the day. We can chit-chat about that. I am delighted a little bit to talk about some of the innovation we make. I want to point out that I'm going to talk about assessments and the strives and changes and innovation we've driven into assessments. I'm happy to talk to you about other aspects of Pearson whose accessibility track record is not that great, but I am the assessments guy, so I plan to talk about assessments. We're already seeing, however, generalization of our efforts to make our tools accessible in assessments going to the other parts of Pearson. So I'm optimistic that we've changed the corner and we're making that trek. I'll leave that for you to decide once you hear my talk. Being a subject matter expert in assessments means that most of my life has been focused on what researchers call variance decomposition, or specifically something known as construct irrelevant variance. Now, I know that sounds really important, but all it really means is, you know, when we build measures, a piece of our measure is error, and we want to get it out of our measure, and a piece of our measure is true when we want to keep it in our measure. And that's the almost by definition what psychometricians do when they build measures. Now, before your eyes glaze over and you fall asleep and you dream about lunch and you really do think I'm an accountant, let me try to explain this whole issue of construct irrelevant variance in a very specific and relevant concrete example. In the early 1970s, AT&T was notorious for discriminatory hiring practices. They often hid behind a rare exception to Title VII of the 64 Civil Rights Act called bona fide occupational qualification. Basically, this exception claimed that if a job could only be performed by one gender, for example, lifting a ladder to the top of a panel van, then accommodating that job for the other gender would be outside normal operations and not required. Well, I think the EEOC took your point of view because they essentially went to court in what is now known as the landmark AT&T sex discrimination case and rejected this claim outright, claiming that, and the essence of their victory was claiming that the placement of the ladder on top of the panel van was irrelevant to the skills needed to perform that job. If you re-accommodated that by placing that ladder down on the van, anybody could have access to it. If you think about the simplicity in this and the power of that one simple example, now we understand a little bit better what we mean by construct relevant versus construct irrelevant variance. The placement of the ladder had nothing to do with the job skills, and yet it was being used as a barrier for entry. AT&T, not because they were evil people, did the same thing a lot of people did. They didn't think about how the tool was going to be used by the end user. Arguably, according to EEOC, they did hide behind that bad decision and tried to defend themselves, but ultimately that case was provoked and accommodations were allowed and the panel vans were changed. In measurement and in testing, such accommodations are equally obvious. For example, providing a Braille version of a test for a blind person is a reasonable accommodation because it is obvious that the loss of sight has nothing to do with the cognitive skill in answering the question. Similarly, then, extended time for a Braille user is a good accommodation because it takes longer to use that tool. Supporting graphics for text items should not become an undue burden to test takers, particularly those with varied visual needs. As such, accommodating tables and graphics in assessments has become quite routine. However, what is not so obvious are the rules that govern the accommodations or the evidence for just what constitutes undue burden. For example, in the ADA Act of the 1990s, federal law now required testing accommodations for cognitive disabilities, such as dyslexia, as well as other physical disabilities. But such accommodations might actually impact the validity of the measures. The court has been very wishy-washy on where the line is drawn on this issue of cognitive accommodations. Now, you might say this is all well and good, you know, but what have you done for me lately? Aren't these things that the assessment industry have been doing and should be doing as we evolve to make goods and services more and more accessible? I agree they are, but don't forget, it was in my lifetime where we used to have the non-standard administration flag, a flag on a student's report card that any student that would engage in assessment in any non-standard fashion would get, a flag that my friends at the Arc of Texas called the scarlet letter of assessments in the day. Just like when the Bell Lab engineers in Murray Hill, New Jersey, put the ladder on top of the van, they were not thinking of the final solution, how it would be used by the end users. Just like my predecessors in assessments did not anticipate the many diverse needs of their users when they came up with this idea of no exceptions. It reminds me of a wonderful book that I've read that for all intents and purposes is a primer on what is known as user-centered design. It's called The Psychology of Everyday Things. It's by Don Norman. And I'd like to quote that for a second. Humans, I have discovered, do not always behave clumsily. Humans do not always err, but they do when the things they use are badly conceived and poorly designed. Nonetheless, we see human error blamed for all of society's pitfalls. While we all blame ourselves, the real culprit, faulty design, goes undetected. Accessibility is all about good user-centered design and making products and services fit for purpose for everyone. We can no longer ratchet something onto an assessment at the end and call it accessible. Now, under NCLB, and we could have a debate about the value of NCLB, but we'd have to agree a lot of light and focus was spent on students with disabilities. I recall testifying at a Senate Ed hearing in Texas. I was making the usual argument about how we are constructing on grade level multiple choice assessments aligned to curriculum standards, but I was doing so for what was known as the 1% population at the time. These would be our most significantly cognitively impaired students. Purpose of the law was to engage with them more than life skills, to teach them subject matter knowledge. I felt proud that we had done such a good job building scaffolding for the teachers, having teacher support and training, peer tutoring and online interactive qualifications for teachers. I remember thinking how well the rubrics were crafted that helped the teachers decide how much independence the students would have in engaging these tests. When I was done, a teacher from one of the schools in Texas, who never took her eye off me, it was a dagger stare straight at me, wanted to talk about how invalid, unreliable, and useless the assessments were, because everybody knew these children with these cognitive disabilities could not learn, and they certainly could not learn on grade level. Now, what struck home for me wasn't the obvious. It wasn't the bias or tyranny of low expectations that this teacher held, or even the notion that the teacher was maintaining a status quo in a school district. What struck home for me was the very product I thought was good failed to meet the criteria because it wasn't really used and implemented to improve instruction in the classroom. If I could make that teacher see what those assessments might have done for those children in her classroom, had they been challenged to reach that level, it would be an interesting thought experiment to see today. In many ways, the current evolution of accessible assessments is the same. Building a Braille test, following the principles of universal design, ensuring that existing technologies work is just not good enough. We started behind making assessments accessible, and we need to do more to catch up and to close the gap, particularly as we evolve into more and more of a digital age. We're making some progress in this regard. As President Riccobono reflected, we need to go faster, but we are making some progress. First and foremost, we hired a dedicated group under Jan McSorley to pay attention to nothing but accessibility inside assessments. And what she did, which was quite controversial to my management, is she immediately engaged the National Federation of Blind. What we've done is we're working toward a better understanding of what access barriers are faced by people with disabilities. For example, we've sent our developers, our content authors, our user experience professionals into the classroom to observe students with disabilities and to talk with them and their teachers about how to improve accessibility of our products. What a brilliant idea. Too bad it was an afterthought. You think you might talk to the people who are using your products before you design your products. Hiring subject matter experts who understand the best design principles with the flexibility needed to respond to individual needs of people with disabilities. Again, you would think that would be a no-brainer, but we're doing that in assessments now. Investing in innovation by tackling the long-standing problem of limited access, particularly in math, for students who are blind. We're developing an accessible equation editor that can be used on assessments and in the classroom. This equation editor can do now what has never been done in the history of math. It dynamically translates printed math into Nemeth code, and Nemeth code into printed math, does it accurately and in real time. I do hope you got a chance to engage with the accessible equation editor in the vendor hall or doing the user studies at the convention. If not, no worries. We'd be happy to set up a demo site. We'd be happy to give you a tutorial. Again, probably the right person to contact is Jan McSorley. That's Jan.McSorley, McSorley, at Pearson. And she'll be happy to set up a time to walk you through the equation editor. But here's a simple story I want to tell that came from the convention this week that's both moving and powerful, though it leaves me sad. Sometime this week, while at the booth, Sam Dooley, one of Jan's team, was demonstrating accessible equation editor. As Sam was showing the editor, 7-year-old blind girl walked up to the table with her parents. They said that she was a Braille reader and that she was learning Nemeth Braille, which is the Braille code for math. Sam introduced himself and asked her, "Would you like to type some math on the computer?" She asked, "Are you going to be my math teacher?" For those of us who've taught children of that age, that's a penetrating question, isn't it? Sam said, "Tell me if you can read what I type," and Sam typed the number 1 on his laptop. 1, she said, as her face started to brighten. Sam typed a plus sign, then the number 2. 1 plus 2, she exclaimed, with pride. Then 1 plus 2 plus 3, as Sam continued to type. At this point, Sam said, "Now let's make it harder," and Sam typed equal sign. "Equal sign," she said with anticipation, starting to see what was coming next. Sam asked her, "Do you know what 1 plus 2 plus 3 is?" 3 plus 2 is 5, plus 1 is 6," she replied. Sam said, "That's correct. Do you know how to type 6 in Braille?" She put her tiny fingers on the keyboard, on the Braille keys, and searched around to find where they should go. Then the sound of dots 2, 3, and 5 went down, and the numeral 6 appeared on the screen in front of her parents. "That's right," Sam exclaimed, with her parents looking on. "Mommy, Mommy," she said, "you can read my math." She cried and she jumped up and down as only a 7-year-old can when they discover how big the world is. This story is very simple, it's moving, yet it's powerful. Answering a simple math question should not be a big deal. It was simple, though not easy, to build an equation, an accessible mathematics equation editor. The power was really in the empowerment the young girl felt. Perhaps the same empowerment we felt when we learned how to read independently. My enthusiasm and joy of this story, however, is tempered. I simply can't help but think that's as it should be. That shouldn't be an exciting day in a child's life to do what everybody else is doing. This is perhaps where my passion lies. Being a former accountant, it's hard to claim I have passion. But by utilizing simple, user-centered design principles to build accessibility into our products and services, such that all students will benefit from their use, and not added as an afterthought, is my goal. So as we evolve into the future, we'll continue to evolve our thinking. We'll continue to work with the NFB, and we hope we can generalize such small successes to the rest of the realm of the great Pearson Enterprise. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Thank you. Thank you.
Recipes. This month's recipes come from the NFB of California. Potato Casserole by Charlotte Carroll. Charlotte Carroll is the president of the NFB of California Senior Division and the first vice president of the Pathfinders chapter of Los Angeles. She joined the NFB in March 2014 because she truly believes in our philosophy. Ingredients: 1/3 cup coconut oil, 1 pound ground turkey, 3 cloves garlic chopped, 1 large red bell pepper or color of your choice, 1 large onion, 6 celery stalks, 2 pounds potatoes peeled and sliced, 1 can cream of celery soup, 1 can cream of mushroom soup. Method: in a skillet, melt coconut oil, brown ground turkey with garlic and set aside. Chop the bell pepper, onion, and celery into small pieces. Add the sliced potatoes. Mix cream of celery soup with cream of mushroom soup. Combine all of the ingredients into a baking dish. Cover with aluminum foil. Bake at 350 degrees for 1 hour or until potatoes are done. Serve with your choice of meat, vegetable, and/or salad. Serves 8. Crispy Honey Barbecue Wings by Rochelle Houston. Rochelle Houston is the treasurer of the National Federation of the Blind of California and the president of the Pathfinder chapter of Los Angeles. She created this recipe because she enjoyed eating the wings at a fast food establishment. Ingredients: 3 pounds chicken wings, 1 bottle of Sweet Baby Ray barbecue sauce, 1/2 cup brown sugar, 2 cups flour, lemon pepper to taste, garlic powder to taste, onion powder to taste. Method: preheat oven to 450 degrees. Wash chicken well. Place chicken in a large bowl and lightly season with lemon pepper, garlic powder, and onion powder. Coat chicken with flour. Lightly grease a cookie sheet or baking dish with cooking spray. Place chicken on baking dish. Cook for 30 minutes, turning chicken over after 20 minutes. Remove from oven. Place barbecue sauce and brown sugar in a saucepan. Stir and simmer on medium heat for 10 minutes. Dip each piece of chicken in sauce. Coat completely. You can fry chicken instead of baking. Serves 6. Chicken Tamale Casserole by Joyce Steigel. Joyce Steigel is a member of the San Fernando Valley chapter of the NFB of California, president of the Diabetes Action Network of California, and treasurer of the Diabetes Action Network Division. She says, "I made up the recipe because I wanted to eat tamales, but I wanted to have some vegetables and more protein with them." Ingredients: 2 cups cauliflower, 4 stalks celery, diced, 1 half purple onion, diced, 12 ounces chicken, cooked and diced, 2 cups frozen corn kernels, 1 cup cheddar cheese, grated, 1 cup jack cheese, grated, 1 cup chunky salsa, I prefer paste picante sauce, 2 chicken tamales, diced. Method: steam the cauliflower with 2 teaspoons of water in the microwave with lid for 2 minutes on high. Set aside. When cool, dice the cauliflower. Place the diced celery and diced onion with 1 tablespoon of water in the microwave for 3 minutes on high. Place the first 8 ingredients in a 2-quart microwave-saved casserole dish and stir well. Then dice the 2 tamales and stir into the casserole dish. Cook on high for 20 minutes, covered. Let it rest for 5 minutes uncovered, and then serve. Enjoy. Jana's Peanut Butter Cookies by Bill Passmore. Jana Luttrell is a member of the California Board of Directors and our philosophy expert. Bill bakes these cookies for her as a treat after a long week teaching Braille at the Orientation Center for the Blind in Albany, California. Ingredients: 2 1/2 cups white flour, 1 teaspoon baking powder, 1 1/2 teaspoons baking soda, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 2 sticks unsalted butter, 1 cup crunchy peanut butter, 1 cup packed brown sugar, 1 cup white sugar, 2 eggs. Method: preheat oven to 375 degrees. In a medium-sized bowl, sift together white flour, baking powder, baking soda, and salt. In a large bowl, cream together the peanut butter, butter, and sugars. Next, add the eggs and beat well. Add the dry ingredients and stir to combine. Place in refrigerator for at least 1 hour. Roll into 1-inch balls and place on an ungreased cookie sheet. Bake for 7 to 10 minutes. Let cool before removing from cookie sheet. Enjoy with a big glass of milk. Banana Cake with Cream Cheese Frosting by Mary Willows. There is a photo on the page, the caption, Mary Willows. Mary Willows has served as president for the California affiliate for the past 7 1/2 years. Over the past 40 years, Mary has held positions in many state and national divisions. In 2006, she was presented with the Blind Educator of the Year Award. Mary loves to bake and entertain. Here's what she says about this banana cake recipe. If you grew up on Sara Lee banana cake and frosting, this recipe will take you back. It is said to be a copycat of the original. Everyone loves it. Ingredients for the cake: 1 1/2 cups ripe bananas, 3 cups flour, 1 1/2 teaspoons baking soda, 1/4 teaspoon salt, 3/4 cup butter, room temperature, 2 1/8 cups sugar, 3 eggs, 2 teaspoons vanilla, I use banana extract, 1 1/2 cups buttermilk. Ingredients for the frosting: a double batch for crumb coat and finish coat, 1 cup butter, room temperature, 2 8-ounce packages cream cheese, room temperature, 2 teaspoons vanilla, again I use banana extract, 7 cups powdered sugar, 2 to 3 tablespoons milk. Method: preheat your oven to 275 degrees, 250 degrees if using a convection oven. Grease and flour 2 9-inch round cake pans. In a small bowl, mash ripe bananas until almost smooth. Use dark brown, black, ultra-ripe bananas if you have them. In a medium bowl, combine flour, baking soda, and salt. In stand mixer, with paddle attachment, cream together butter and granulated sugar on medium-high speed for 5 minutes until the mixture is light and fluffy. Reduce the mixer speed to medium and add the eggs, one at a time, beating well after each addition, and add vanilla. Reduce the mixer speed to slow and slowly add in the flour mixture alternately with the buttermilk, starting and ending with the flour mixture. Add in mashed bananas. Pour batter into prepared pans and bake for 60 to 70 minutes, or until toothpick inserted into center of the cakes comes out clean. As soon as the cakes are done, immediately remove them from the oven and place them directly into the freezer for 45 minutes. This will make the cake very moist. While the cakes are cooling, mix together the frosting crumb coat. In stand mixer with paddle attachment, combine 1/2 cup soft butter and 1 package soft cream cheese. Cream together on medium-high speed for 3 to 5 minutes until the mixture is light and fluffy. Turn mixer to slow and add in 1 teaspoon vanilla. Turn mixer off and add in 1 cup of powdered sugar. Be sure not to overpack measuring cup with powdered sugar. Turn mixer to its slowest setting and mix until sugar is incorporated. Do this step 2 more times, and on the last time, add in an extra 1/2 cup powdered sugar for a grand total of 3 1/2 cups powdered sugar for 1 full batch. After cakes are cool, remove them from the pans and level the tops if necessary. Add a dollop of frosting to the base of your cake plate and place the first layer. Add parchment paper under edges of bottom layer to catch any frosting drippings. Frost top of bottom layer, be generous, and then place second layer on top of the frosted bottom layer. Frost top of the second layer and the sides of both layers with a thin coating of frosting. This will lock in the crumbs. Place cake into the refrigerator so the crumb coat will firm up about 60 to 90 minutes. While cake is firming up, whip up the finishing coat of frosting by repeating the process you used to make the crumb coat, on the last step adding enough milk to loosen up the frosting until it drops in large clumps off of a spatula. Remove cold cake from the refrigerator and start frosting from the center of the top of the cake to the sides and then down the sides. Depending on how much frosting you like, you might have some left over. After you get the frosting to your liking, slowly remove the parchment paper from the bottom of the cake. Store the cake in the refrigerator or in an airtight cake container. It should keep for 3 to 5 days. Notes: I have made this cake in both a 9x13-inch size and in cupcakes, and it works great every time. I only make 1 batch of frosting when I make these sizes. Monitor Miniatures, news from the Federation family. Voter information available on NFB Newsline. The best tool for voters is information. In an effort to help our subscribers become more informed voters, NFB Newsline has added candidate information for the upcoming presidential elections. Just in time for the November 8 election, you can log into NFB Newsline and get up-to-the-minute information about the leading candidates for the 2016 presidential election. To hear about the candidates using the telephone access method, press 5 on the main menu for Newspapers in a Different State, then 5 for 2016 presidential election. From there you can choose Breaking News, Daily Newspaper, International, or Magazine search results for Clinton or Trump. You will be able to read articles from today's and yesterday's publications. To read about candidates for the 2016 presidential election using NFB Newsline Mobile, choose Publications, then Publication Options, then All Publications, and look for Breaking News search results, or Daily Newspaper search results, or International search results, or Magazine search results for Clinton and Trump to read the most current information available. In order to obtain this information, we have performed a global search for the candidates under Breaking News or Daily Newspaper or International or Magazines, and created the articles listed in this new section called 2016 Presidential Election. To obtain further information, you can use the global search function to search under additional topics. Additional election information will be added as it becomes available. Don't forget to get out and vote. A report from the PEAT Committee. The Promotion, Evaluation, and Advancement of Technology Committee met June 30, 2016, and gave most of the technology exhibitors a chance to talk about what was in their booths when the exhibits opened on Friday. There was lots of emphasis on Braille this year, and much interest was stirred by the new video remote assistive services soon to be available. A good crowd was on hand to hear our speakers, and at the end of the program, Claire von Herfen explained how the committee could help the Jernigan Institute. She would like to know what barriers are affecting our lives the most, and we discussed one on which the Institute needs immediate input: inaccessible home appliances. For those wishing to give me information on either of these points, I'll be glad to hear it. The best way to reach me is at 601-529-8629, or email me at Mark Jones, Mark, at Vicksburg, VICKSBURGV, number 105.com. The program began with OrCam, which has new and better software for its camera-equipped glasses which allow reading and face recognition. The Bookshare asked the question, why can't books be born accessible? AI Squared mentioned its merger with the parent company that now also owns Freedom Scientific and Optelec. Ann Taylor, now with Microsoft, talked about significant progress with Microsoft's screen reader, Narrator. Daryl Templeton of MegaVoice talked about the first solar-powered audio recorder player called the Envoy EZ, that's smaller than a cell phone, has lots of onboard memory, and costs just $60. Dolphin, which has been doing screen reading for 30 years, has its new bookshelf, which allows access to several content providers such as Bookshare, NFB Newsline, and NLS Bard directly from its Supernova product that will transfer information to a Windows computer or Victor Stream with just two keystrokes. Mike Tyndall of Humanware talked about their new Braille Note Touch, the first Google-certified Braille tablet. Amanda Tolson of Envision told us about the new ID Mate Galaxy with more grocery product descriptions than ever before, and their Script Talk that has a new and better scanner. Our program continued with ERA speaking about their video remote assistance solutions, allowing a person wearing the company's glasses containing a built-in camera to receive real-time help from a live human on the other end of a mobile connection. The VT Secure folks also have a new product called the Lantern, which detects objects from as far away as 200 feet and contains a haptic compass. When worn on the wrist, the device can greatly enhance cane travel. NCR and Cardtronics talked about their accessible ATM touchscreen solutions. Then the American Printing House for the Blind discussed its new scientific calculator with accessible scientific and math options and discussed the new Nearby Explorer Android mapping application that works with a GPS device for finding your way to anywhere. Additionally, the APH folks talked about the new 20-cell Braille display that will sell for $500 or less when released in October. It's called the Orbit Reader. Stephen Baum of Kurzweil was next on the program and mentioned his 22-year career at Kurzweil, working with the Kurzweil 1000. He's looking for input from users for the new version 15 that he's currently working on. Then Ron Miller, with the VFO Group, formerly Freedom Scientific, spoke about the new EL Braille that's being released soon, which is a Windows 10 computer with a small Braille display. Lloyd Rasmussen told us that NLS is working on Braille output for Bard Mobile for Android. AT Guys talked about many new products, including a Switch-connected plug that would enable Siri to turn on and off different devices in your home from afar. Clara von Herfen closed the presentation portion of the program with news about the new comprehensive technology resource list now being made available in an updatable form by the NFB's International Braille and Technology Center. I'd like to remind everyone who plans to be in Orlando next year that this meeting is open to all and is a great way to find out what's going to be in the exhibit hall before the exhibits open. We also took questions this year from the audience. You don't have to be on the committee to attend, and this is a wonderful way to get answers to your most pressing technology questions. In brief, notices and information in this section may be of interest to monitor readers. We are not responsible for the accuracy of the information. We have edited only for space and clarity. Adult Rehabilitation and Employment Survey. We are looking for you. If you are blind or visually impaired, reside in the United States, and are at least 18 years of age, we cordially invite you to participate in this survey. Its purpose is to gain a better understanding of your experiences as an adult who is blind or visually impaired, including your experiences with education, employment, training, and vocational rehabilitation. The survey should not take more than 10 minutes of your time. If you complete this survey, you will be entered into a drawing in which 5 individuals will win a $100 Visa gift card. We offer you 3 ways to complete the survey. Go to www.pdrib.com/ares, email pdrib2016@gmail.com, or call 318-257-2029. Thank you for taking the time to better help us understand the lived experiences of adults with visual impairments. Questions or concerns about this survey may be directed to Edward Bell, Principal Investigator, Professional Development and Research Institute on Blindness, by calling 318-257-4554 or by sending him an email at ebell@latech.edu. The 2017 Ski for Light International Week. The 42nd Annual Ski for Light International Week will be held from Sunday, February 5 through Sunday, February 12, 2017. The event will take place on the grounds of Snow Mountain Ranch in Granby, Colorado, near Winter Park. Snow Mountain Ranch is a 5,100-acre year-round recreational complex that includes a 100-kilometer cross-country trail system consistently rated as one of the top 10 Nordic venues in the country. This year we will be housed right on the grounds of Snow Mountain Ranch, so participants will be able to access the trail system just a short distance from their front door. Also on the property are a lighted tubing hill, a covered outdoor ice skating rink, fat bike, snowshoe and hiking trails, an indoor pool and sauna, a roller skating rink, an indoor climbing wall, a craft center, a horse stable, and much more. cost for the week-long event this year will be a choice of $690 or $775 per person for double room occupancy. Other options will range from $550 for a four-person room to $1,125 for a single room. The room rate you choose will also cover all meals, as well as transportation to and from the Denver airport to the ski site and trail passes. Partial financial stipends based on need for first and second time participants will be considered upon request. Applications are requested by November 1. Applications received after this date will be considered on a space available basis. Full details about the event and the accessible online application, which can be completed on the Ski for Light website, can be found at www.sfl.org. If you are a novice and want to learn how to cross-country ski, or if you have skied before and just want to be matched with an experienced guide and meet new friends for a wonderful week of fun in the snow, this is the event for you. Individuals interested in attending can also contact Visually Impaired Participant Application Coordinator Tim McCorkle at 206-522-5850 or t_McCorkle@comcast.net. Seedlings Braille Books for Children offers free books. Seedlings Braille Books for Children invites Braille readers and pre-readers from ages 0 to 21 in the United States and Canada to register to receive two free Braille books per year. This amazing program, called the Book Angel Program, was originally called Anna's Book Angel Project and was named in memory of our director's 19-year-old daughter, who was tragically killed by a drunk driver in 2001. Each year, blind children who were registered received one free book in Anna's name, but now we're doing even more. Thanks to Seedlings' generous donors, blind children in the U.S. and Canada can receive two free Braille books per year. Seedlings offers 1,300 titles, from contemporary literature to well-loved classics, and continues to add new titles each year so that visually impaired children have the opportunity to read the same books their sighted peers are reading. The Book Angel program is a wonderful way to introduce a visually impaired child to the marvel of Braille literacy. Here is a testimonial from a parent who ordered her first Braille books for her son from the Book Angel program. Alex has always been a curious boy and loves to read anything he gets his hands on. He received his first Braille book from Seedling's Book Angel program when he was a baby, and the print Braille format allowed me to read to him while he could touch the Braille, just as a sighted child would look at the words as he listens to bedtime stories. Thank you. To order free books for your child or student, fill out the form located on the Seedling's website, http://www.seedlings.org/bkangel2009.php. Note, this is a continuing program, but registration is required each year to participate, since book choices must be communicated to Seedlings. Computers for the Blind lowers prices on laptops. In an effort to make accessible laptops more affordable to students and others, Computers for the Blind is dropping the price from $160 to $130. These laptops come loaded with powerful software that will enhance the education, employability, independence, and quality of life of those who can least afford them. No age or income requirements. We also honor this price for organizations. Join the 9,000 consumers who have benefited from our computers. Talking Typing Teacher is still available on CFTB computers for $10, 90% of retail, through Marvelsoft. For more information, visit http://www.computersfortheblind.net or email info@computersfortheblind.net. Resource Handbooks available. I have created 17 screen reader-friendly resource handbooks containing resources pertaining to the blind and visually impaired for use by consumers and professionals. This handbook is for the residents of specific states and includes the many organizations for the blind and visually impaired, covering areas such as employment, housing, transportation, and more. Currently, the handbooks are for Alabama, Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, California, Colorado, Delaware, Florida, Hawaii, Illinois, Nevada, New Jersey, New York, Ohio, Oregon, Pennsylvania, and Texas. The handbooks include contact information on the local, regional, and national level. For more information on pricing and formats, please contact Insightful Publications by email at insightfulpub@gmail.com, by phone at 808-747-1006, or by visiting http://www.in-sightful.com/orderpage.html for more information on pricing, formats, availability, and state resource handbook order form. Braille Candy Calendar available. we are very excited to announce the arrival of a beautiful Braille Christmas Advent calendar. This unique and special calendar is produced in Germany by Kampmann International and has been distributed throughout Europe for the past 5 years. Each of the 24 windows representing the 24 days in December leading up to Christmas is embossed in Braille, and behind each window is a piece of premium European milk chocolate, not only wonderful for someone who is blind, but also wonderful as a learning tool for anyone and at any age. There is a limited quantity available and will only be sold through November 10, 2016. The calendar is $14.95 with free shipping, and calendars are mailed the same day as the order is received. To order, please use the following link to Alex's Pantry, http://www.alexspantry.com/holiday-pantry/braille-advent-calendar. If you have questions or wish to discuss a large quantity order, please contact the executive importer, JSI Importers and Distributors, at 800-422-2595, extension 1, and ask for Nancy. NFB Pledge. I pledge to participate actively in the efforts of the National Federation of the Blind to achieve equality, opportunity, and security for the blind, to support the policies and programs of the Federation, and to abide by its Constitution.